Hello, everybody, and welcome to the September 8th, 2015 edition of Weekly Manga Recap. Special Tuesday time again, because Nick can't do it on Wednesday this week. Chris, how are you
Tuesday,
doing?
Tuesday!
You know that fucking... It's the Tuesday song!
Yeah! You know the Elton John song, Friday Night's Alright? No, I guess that was my bad lead-in. Like, hey, Nick, do you know that Elton John song?
Nope.
With Tiny Dancer?
Nope.
Hold me closer, Tiny Dancer.
Elton John, he does the...
Is he the one that Matt Damon blew up and down behind the candelabra? I'm like, no, but close. I forget the song's Friday. I know Nickelback covered it for a boxing show at one point called Saturday Night is Alright for Fighting. I feel like Tuesday night should temporarily on weeks when our schedule doesn't permit it to be normally be on its Wednesday night is alright for manga podcasts.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not as catchy. But I think we could still probably pay
Tuesday night's alright for Weekly Manga Recap. Squeeze it all in there.
Just crowbar it in there. This is a tumultuous point for me, Nick. Mm-hmm. This is the first year in probably like 7 years now where a football season's starting, and I am not in any fantasy football leagues whatsoever.
Yeah, it's I broke my very short-lived trend, I think, last year. It's been a while now since I've been involved in fantasy football. Just really don't make the time for it anymore. So,
is it a sign? Because I think both of us can agree we've fallen a little bit out of our intense fervor of football.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a sign that we're maturing or that we're getting more lame?
I think that it's just a sign that I spend the time that I have on other lame hobbies.
We're getting lamer.
Yeah.
Like, we took the one mildly, like, masculine and cool thing that we did, and we replaced it with Hearthstone, and I assume you have, like, an advanced calculating class you take or something.
Well, I'm involved in two podcasts, which are both about kind of nerdy topics. One's more nerdy than the other.
Hold on a moment. I don't know if I'm defending myself or just clarifying something. The wrestling one's the nerdier one, right?
No, manga's the nerdier one.
Oh, no.
It's still more mainstream than manga. I hate to break it to you.
Oh, dear.
What else do I do?
I do your remembering Robot Wars?
Yeah, I do a blog about that. In general, I have less free time now. Because I, you know, have more real life stuff to take care of now. So, I think that that's more it, honestly, than just the way that I spend my free time, is I just have less of it.
God forbid one of us has kids. I don't know what we'd do at that point. Like, I have to assume, of course, the responsibility falls on the child, like, to take care of the child, but I'm like, what do I... If I'm already, like, oh, I have to, like, cherry-pick what nerdy hobbies I'm going to attach myself to, once that responsibility comes into it, it's like, how do I even find time to... read manga or fucking play trading cards online and
gonna have to get used to browsing manga with using your both hands to change a diaper. You know, like, have to use your foot to scroll through the pages.
Oh my god, no! I'll be Zora. I'll do it with my mouth, and I'll somehow manipulate my tongue to flip it across.
Okay, I'll prop it open and I'll do this part of it and say, oh no, not another full page spread. Fuck you, Kubo.
Until inevitably one day I'm like, this manga sucks, and I drop the phone out of my mouth and it hits the baby, and at that point I'm like banned from phones and the baby alone. So I feel like that's an inevitability. But now I'm still gonna watch football, but I'm a little disappointed I don't have a league this year. I'm just like, I guess it's the magic's over.
I got used to not doing it for a while because I left one league and then I didn't really have one. It's like I met a few a few guys online that were actually interested in doing it, and then that league finally fell apart a couple years ago, and so I'm just like, whatever, done. That's basically it for me. I mean, it's, you know, just I fell out of fantasy football the same way everyone else does. Just like, I don't feel like doing it anymore.
This is cumbersome, and I always lose.
Yeah, it's way too much research for way too little reward, basically.
Inevitably, when the one fucking person who barely even pays attention to their team is the one who wins it all anyway.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating. You know what? If I stop watching football, though, Nick, I got to see 2 Super Bowls live. Well, not live. I mean, 2 Super Bowls won, you know, during the time I was a fan. And that's a pretty damn good ratio. I should actually probably cut my losses here.
Stop caring
about it. Just stop watching football completely. So this way I'm like, nah, from the 8-year span, I followed the Giants. 2 of those years, they won the Super Bowl.
That's
so
pretty damn good, yeah.
That's awesome.
I haven't loyally followed the Bucks of late, but I mean, I was a big fan of theirs for going on like more than 10 years. I was happy to get one, you know. So, yeah, 1 every 4 years is a good ratio.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on from football to baseball. Kind of. Sort of. Little bit. My recommendation this week is Cross Game, which is allegedly a baseball manga. It is a series by Mitsuru Adachi, who has been doing sports-themed romantic comedy manga for going on, like, 25 years now, I think, is how long he's been doing it. Might be longer. I think maybe he's actually up to, like, 30 or something like that. The point is, he's been doing it a very long time, and he had been doing it for a very long time when this series first started coming out in 2005 or so. Cross Game is actually probably the best known and most successful of his manga, and it even like won this big Shonen Manga Award a few years into its run. Very well critically received series, but I knew better going in. I knew better
because I've been burned. Warning I should have gotten?
I have been burned by Adachi Sensei twice, and I knew what to expect. And he started to try and get me off my guard in the first, year of publication with this series. And then I was just like, oh, nope, I see you. This is really a Mitsuru Adachi series. You tried to fool me, but I see all your tropes creeping in there. And I know how this is going to end. You're not going to get me this time. I am going to detach myself. And that decision paid off because it ended like many Mitsuru Adachi series ended and went the way that many of them do. But I'll get into how much like the rest of this guy's work this series really is as we get into this discussion.
And what is this guy's work? Like, I'm not familiar with the name before.
I talked briefly about Mitsuru Adachi in the Q&A episode we did for August. Hmm. In terms of series that basically disappointed me. Basically, the guy does a lot of sports-themed romantic comedy stuff, which a lot of which follows the same general structure. He basically has his style of doing stuff, and he has stuck to it. He did a series in the 80s called Rough. He did a series in the 90s called H2, which was also a baseball manga, but it ran for much longer than Cross Game did. It ran from like 92 to 99, I want to say. And, you know, in general, you've got a male protagonist who's involved in the sport. You've got a female love interest who is interested in the sport to varying degrees, somewhat varying degrees, but is generally pretty invested in it. And the manga focuses on if they're going to get together, and they will. Sort of. You won't see them get together, but they probably do. I think they do. We'll get into that. Let's actually talk, I think, a bit about Cross Game itself, because Cross Game does do something very, very different from most of the rest of Adachi's series, which is it begins on I think a very good note. Basically, we're introduced to our main characters far before the bulk of the series actually takes place, because most of it takes place when they're like, what, 15? I think I want to say. That age range.
I was gonna say when it starts, they're like they look like I don't know what age they're supposed to be. They look like they're 8, but it might be like the reverse anime syndrome where these just happen to be the few.
They're
characters.
Actually older in the beginning.
Yeah, they're not like 8, you know, 5 foot 9 with gigantic breasts and are like, I'm 13! Like, you're screwing with me.
And it's interesting because Adachi's been doing manga for so long and he settled into his own style, it's actually interesting because the series was published in like 2005, but it looks like an 80s series. You know, very soft character designs, very rounded and so on and so forth. More of a note of realism than you get in a lot of shonen manga where everyone's got incredibly distinct designs. But yeah, everyone at this, you know, is like, you know, got black hair or brown hair and normal hairstyles. Normal faces for the most part, but they are cartoonish enough at certain points that you can tell most of the important characters apart. Although, funnily enough, a lot of the important characters look like other important characters from series that Adachi has done before, which is actually a joke he makes himself at one point in the series, where like his characters look like his previous characters. Adachi has another thing where he likes to break the fourth wall a lot, and he does that a fuck ton in this manga.
I was gonna say, like, isn't like one of the, maybe it's the first chapter or the second chapter, he makes a joke about like, being a baseball player is not so bad. You could be a manga artist instead and make no money or something like that. He just draws himself in like a room being sad.
He does that a ton. Like, there's one moment where like there's a bit where the characters break character in order to talk about how hard it is to be a mangaka, and they're like speaking directly to the reader through the panel while the other one is looking confused about what they're doing. There's a bit where he talks about himself, where like the characters will talk about previous manga that they've read. There's one where they actually talk about their own series, where they go, have you read this one by this guy? And they say, oh, that thing's not actually about baseball, is it? It's like, ha ha ha. Yeah. The thing about him is that, about Mitsurudachi, is that his sense of humor is good, unless you have seen it over and over and over again. Because he does the same jokes over and over again. They've worked for 20 years. They'll work this time.
He's got like his pocket of jokes that he's just gonna hold on to no matter what.
Yeah, he's got his tater salad routine, and he's gonna tell it until it stops making him money.
Oh man, I love Ron White, but holy shit! If you've watched one stand-up special of his within the past 15 years, you've seen them all.
He's got that one about the plane ride that he and his wife were on. He's got the
can't fix set. Stupid.
Yeah. Same thing over and over.
Great comedian, but holy crap!
So that was probably the main thing about this series that prevented me from enjoying it more than I probably would have. Because I agree that lots of the stuff in this series is very good. It's just that he keeps following into his old habits, and I've seen it so many times. I'm just like, yeah, I've seen this before. I get it. You can stop poking fun at yourself. You can stop shamelessly shilling as a joke. I get it. Because he does that too. He'll talk about like series of his that are done running and how you can check them out and where you can go to find the volumes and stuff. Just in the series, randomly, that break character in order to talk about it. And it's funny the first few times, but the first few times were in like the first series I read of his.
And now that it's
years
like
ago.
Another decade-long series, like, alright, how about we chillax and,
Yeah, for as long as these guys' series tend to run, or at least his more successful ones, because Cross Game lasts about 6 years or so, you think that you would have time in order to do other stuff. Nah, just stick to the old stuff. Okay, fine.
Yeah, do that again.
Getting into what sets Cross Game apart from his other series, though, is the way that it actually starts. As we started to get into before I went on another tangent, we are introduced to the main characters actually when they're like 10 years old, and this is like 5 years or so before the bulk of the super story takes place. So we've got this male protagonist, Ko Kitamura, who is good friends with the Tsukishima family, particularly their second daughter, Wakaba, who is almost the exact same age as him. They were born very close to each other. I think they're born on the same day, in fact. They make a big deal about that. And they're incredibly good friends. They're very close to each other. People joke about the fact that they're probably going to get married someday. The second, the female lead is Alba, who's Bakaba's younger sister, by like a year. So they're still very close in age, both Ko and Alba and Wakaba and Alba. So the first 10 chapters or so build up that this incredible bond between them and how close they are to each other, and also the fact that they're interested in baseball. Like, Alba is incredibly dedicated to it. She wants to be a pitcher, despite the fact that she's a girl and she can't, really. Wakaba is basically kind of close to the game as well, I guess because of Alba's interest in it, and so she thinks that Ko should get involved in it, but he's not really that interested in himself. And so they just kind of go through their lives, and then Wakaba just dies. She goes on a camping trip to, like, some sort of summer camp, and there's stormy weather, and she drowns while swimming. And it's executed in this incredibly low-key, subdued, real manner where you just see Ko at home watching TV, and he goes in the kitchen to get something, and he hears this news flash that a young girl has drowned, and he hears that her name is Wakaba. And he doesn't break down or anything. He just kind of goes into shock through the funeral. Through the days after that, he has to go to this summer festival because he and Wakaba have been planning to go to it together. And everyone's like, how can you do that at a time like this? And except for, like, one adult who's like, just let him go. You know, you don't know what he's going through. Just, you know, let him go to his own devices. And so he goes, and he eventually just kind of, like, comes back and leans against the wall, and he's like, what the hell am I supposed to do right now? He has no idea how to deal with this, because this is the first tragic thing that's, you know, happened to him. And then he sees this this other guy, this bully, Akiishi, who had a crush on Wakaba, and he's crying at her grave, basically. And he looks at him, and he realizes, oh, that's all I have to do. I have to cry. And he finally actually lets it all out. And that's the first volume of the series, is just this story about these little kids and their close bond, and then one of them dies, and they have to deal with it. Which,
a lot like Stephen King's It.
If you say so, I never...
But there wasn't a giant spider at
the
end.
There was no giant spider or clown or...
Well, if you look closely at a couple panels, you actually see Pennywise sneaking up on them.
They all float!
It's really disturbing. It's
that's how she drowned. Oh,
yeah, she got dragged down by the Pennywise clown. Silly me.
And I mean, that's I think the thing that a lot of people really liked about this is just how it handled this tremendous tragedy that happens to these characters in this subdued manner, as opposed to, you know, people breaking down and going, no, just.
It, like, with a baseball glove in hand, like, in their uniform.
She just wanted me to pay!
No! I'm gonna use this as my motivation to go to the Kyoshin!
What am I fighting for?
And that's when the theme song kicks, like, let's baseball up!
Across the game!
Let's baseball up!
And yeah, I think that it starts off an incredibly good note because it establishes, you know, there's this close bond between these characters, and you know right from the get-go that this is going to affect the bond between the two actual main characters, Ko and Alba, because they were both very close with Wakaba, and they didn't really get along themselves. And also, it's going to affect what Ko is basically going to do for the rest of his life, because this person who he was incredibly close to had such an influence on him, and she wished for him to do certain things. And in general, early on, when they have this kind of unspoken presence with Wakaba, and, you know, understanding that that's the motivation for a lot of characters to do stuff, it's really good, I think. You know, this is why Yoko is going for the baseball team. This is why Akaishi is trying to, you know, get into baseball. And it's understood that he basically stopped being this asshole bully after she died, and he became a much better person because of it. And also, you know, why Alba is helping out Ko and the entire rest of the baseball team, and why they get along with each other and stuff. Having that presence and having it built up over 10 chapters was very effective. Eventually, it does, however, devolve into just typical, like, romantic comedy stuff. And when it loses that kind of unique element, or it starts to fade, or it starts to be specifically played up, then, you know, when it goes too far in either direction, that's when it kind of tends to lose its footing, I think.
But it starts becoming generic, almost.
Yeah, or it becomes too much of a Mitsuru Adachi series, like I said. You know, this is the unique element of the story, is having this and having them be dedicated to this goal of, you know, this is why we're going to try and go to the Koshien. Because, you know, every baseball manga, almost, is about going to the Koshien, because, you know, that's the high school dream, that's what, you know, shonen baseball manga is associated with, is, oh, we gotta get our team together and go to the Koshien and stuff. That's the ultimate goal. But Akiishi at one point specifically says, before the last time I saw her, Wakaba told me about this dream she had, where we were playing baseball in the Koshien, and you, meaning Ko, you were pitching, and I was catching. And that's why he plays catcher instead of pitcher, which he did as a kid, is because he wants to help realize that dream that she had. You know, that's the thing, is like, you know, it's not just let's go to the Koshien, it's let's fulfill Wakaba's dream because she meant so much to us and stuff. Yeah, win-win for the Gipper type of thing.
Who was the Gipper?
Some guy in Notre Dame who got sick and wanted the team to win one for the Gipper.
Okay.
At least he did in a movie. I'm not sure if that's real or not. Yeah.
It's not Rudy, is it?
No.
I was just saying, Nick. I was like,
It's an older movie than Rudy. It was a black and white film.
Okay. Is the movie actually called Win One for the Gipper?
I don't think so. We'd have to look that up.
Can do.
Yeah, go ahead.
I will admit, though, Nick, Win One for the Gipper movie. Nut Rockney? All-American? That can't be how you pronounce his name. I had to be fucking getting his name wrong.
Duke Rockney, All-American.
I know this. I feel like...
The 1940 biographical film which tells the story of Newt Rockney, Notre Dame football coach. It stars Pat O'Brien playing the role of Rockney and Ronald Reagan as player George Gipp, a.k.a. the Gipper.
Hold on. How do you... I have to look this up now.
Who apparently was a real person.
How... Do you pronounce... Oh, thank God, it's one of the first Google options. How to pronounce Newt from pronouncenames.com. Is there... What the fuck is... Canute?
What, like the Viking guy? Like the Danish prince from Vinland Saga?
Well, apparently this is just...
Newt?
I think it's Newt.
Newt Rock... I feel like... Yeah, I feel like that's not how you pronounce his last name, but...
No, it says Canute, actually, on his Wikipedia page. Canute Rockney.
Well, he was a Norwegian. Oh, he was American.
Norwegian, okay. Yeah, there you go. That explains it. Fucking Scandinavian Americans everywhere. God, I hate all of them.
All right. So, I
don't know, or Danish, that's the joke. Okay.
Now that I got violently off topic.
Right.
No, I have to admit that I... Did not... We've been credited before of being somewhat intelligent in our analysis. I definitely have to hand in my card this time, because this was a series that I judged very harshly based off of the artwork.
I can totally get that.
It just looked so old, and the style of narrative for the early chapters was really, really non-eventful. That I think once you get the context later on... You know, of what, you know, it's supposed to be this, it's almost basically like a prologue that will build you up towards the rest of the series. I think that might help give the series some more oomph. But I really lost a lot of my interest during the first few chapters because I was like, this is so old. It's like, I feel like it would be like watching like a 1940s like movie or something like that. Like, I'm just like, unless it's a classic, I feel like I'm just watching something that's really, really old. And I started thinking, like, man, you know what? I should read a Street Rookies now.
At least that one was awesome when nothing was happening. I totally understand that. It is weird to see this, you know, art style that was more prevalent in the 80s being done in the 2000s. It really seems like an older series, because the guy who made it had been doing it a long time ago and has really stuck to his same style, not just of drawing, but also of storytelling. So it's kind of weird to see this thing that I guess would have probably worked better back then being done in much more recent times. Because this, you know, started off, this series only started 10 years ago, and then ended like 6 years ago, I think. So
I was gonna say, if you had paid me to guess, like if you put a bet on for me to guess which decade this was from, I would not have been like 2000. I'd have been like 80s, no, like 70s, no, 60s. Like I just keep going backwards. I'm like, I don't think they were making manga back in 1840s, but I guess they were.
I think that's like when the first manga or something were coming out, I think.
I was like, it's so weird to make a story about modern baseball at a time when so many of the... I don't think the phone was really developed to the point it was in this.
Yes, it was.
Not to that extent, though. She's got a pretty fancy phone.
I don't think... I somehow doubt the Koshin was constructed in 1820, guys.
At that point in time, she would have answered the phone ahoy hoy, just like Alexander Graham Bell demanded of us.
Japanese Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah. Alexander Graham Barrel.
Arikusan del Graham Barrel. Oh, God. So, beyond it being an old type of series, I feel like... Oh, God. This is kind of weird, because... I thought that the actual baseball stuff in the manga, when it was properly explored, was actually pretty good. I thought when it was not just straight up, Cole beats everybody because it's really good, and instead it goes into an in-depth explanation of how the two different teams play off of each other, how their coaches are different, how their players are different, and how the matchups work and stuff. I thought that was when it was good. Like the first big time match that we see is basically when Ko joins the team in high school. Basically, there's this whole thing where a new coach has been brought in. He's being paid a lot of money because he's got a reputation for leading teams to great success. But mostly, he does so by farming talent from everywhere, bringing in all the best players he can, and then running them like a military leader, like a freaking drill sergeant. He doesn't care about developing the players who aren't as good as the top-tier players on the team, and he relegates all of the losers to basically practice in this shed, near this shed and stuff. They're called, like, the cesspool and stuff. And the whole thing is, okay, you know, we've got a chance to show what we can do in this practice match, and some of them do pretty well, but they still lose, basically. So it's like, okay, let's just keep on going, you know, with this guy. And then they, basically from that point on, after that, it just kind of becomes, their opponents are cartoons, honestly. The coach is a cartoon character. The coach of the first team that they play, aside from them, when they're trying to qualify for the Koshien, is a cartoon character. The players are cartoon characters. It's ridiculous. You've got this guy who is basically pure evil and is purely incompetent. You have players, if they disobey him, then they're kicked off the starting squad. But it's just to show that he's wrong and they're right. Everything he does is wrong. He's stubborn. He's incompetent. It's like he's wrong. That is his character. And their next opponent is coached by a guy who is wrong because he has a star player on the team who is wrong because he wants to show off and be awesome, and his only defining character trait is he keeps the rest of the team down so that he'll look good so that he can join the pros. That's it. That's the story pretty much over and over again whenever baseball is involved, which is disappointing because it showed promise when it wasn't doing that in the baseball stuff, I thought. I don't know if you got that impression or not.
I mean, yeah, the baseball stuff itself could be an intriguing development. It was when the story... It had to be into the game, though, because even some of the tangential stuff around baseball, like if they were hanging around a baseball field and doing their shenanigans, that stuff would just bore me instantly. But the actual game itself could be amusing. Again, the artwork pulled me out of it a little bit because there isn't that visualization of the sport that really gave me like a you know, that awe-inspiring kind of moment when watching, you know, the series or watching the sport in action. But I could still enjoy, I could still grasp into that, just the fundamental of competition, and dig into that more than I could the romance, or, you know, let's fuck around a baseball field for a little bit, or let's goof off with my fat friend, or any of that stuff.
I think that's, I mean, that's the thing, is I think that stuff would be more interesting if the characters were more interesting. I mean, some, I have my characters in the series that I like. I actually like Azuma, the second ace of the team besides Ko. Because basically, when we're introduced to him, we're told that he only cares about winning. He's this awesome player who only cares about winning. But rather than just having him be this guy who's like, oh, you guys are, you know, secondary characters and fuck all of you, you're not good or anything like that, he's still incredibly arrogant. But he actually, you know, when basically they've made this bet with this coach where if his, you know, starting players lose to the backups that he's keeping on the bench and preventing them from doing anything, that basically he'll quit. When that happens, Azuma refuses to play. And he says, hey, I only care about winning. You've told me I'm your best player, and you're letting me get away with this. Because you don't care about discipline or anything like that. You just care about, you know, having the best players and winning. Well, this is a way to prove that this is the best team for me. So I'm just going to do the same thing that you're doing. He doesn't be like, oh, you know, obviously I would never lose to these guys. Just like, my goal is actually winning. And I am going to find the best team to do that. I'm going to find the best coach to do that. So he actually consistently does that, and he doesn't actually devolve into, I am the best, totally and definitively. He's actually focused on his goal consistently. And then we get to learn more about him, and we find out his reason for doing stuff is because his brother got injured because he was irresponsible as a kid, and that ruined his baseball dream, so he wants to basically go to the Koshien for himself as well as for his brother, and so on and so forth. So I have my characters that I like him, but I don't think the characters actually change or evolve in the slightest in this entire series. It's like almost 200 chapters long, and there are one-note, one-characteristic characters everywhere. If there's a jerky character, they're just a jerk. That's it. If there's a comic relief character, they are comic relief character for the entire series. They are nothing but a buffoon. Senda, when we're introduced to him, the guy who wants to be the pitcher, but he's not actually better than Ko until he ends up becoming the shortstop, he is only there to deliver jokes and look pathetic and have no luck with girls, even though he thinks that he is a ladies' man, and have no luck with Alba, even though he thinks that he's going to win her heart. That is his entire purpose, is to be the butt of a joke every single time we see him. He never gets to do anything cool. Ever!
He doesn't get that redemption moment. He just sits there and looks like a goober for, what, 17 volumes?
Well, even when, like, he comes through in the clutch for the team at one point by getting a hit, it's like he lucked out.
Like his pants fell down while he was doing it or something.
Basically, you know, like, he immediately brags about it, and they're like, yeah, he just lucked into it. It's like, he's not allowed to do anything cool. He's not allowed to have a cool character moment where he, like, says something wise or anything. He is just a buffoon. That is all he is there for. It's like, you gotta give me a little bit more than that, dude. And, God. So the only thing that really changes is that feelings change a little bit. You know, basically, Ko and Alba start to occasionally realize that they have feelings for each other. Because they're the main couple. You know, it's obvious from the beginning, once Wakaba is dead, that they are going to be the main pair because they're the main guy and girl. There's never a question about it. It's incredibly predictable.
Is there even... I'm trying to think, is there even, like, a secondary girl to, like, make it into a love triangle?
Well, kind of. I mean, most of the obstacles, you know, the people who are there to make love triangles and stuff, it's obvious from the beginning they're not gonna actually end up with them. There's this whole thing with Akane, who is this girl who ends up moving in about halfway through the series, and she looks a lot like Wakaba. That is her whole thing. She looks like Wakaba, but she's not Wakaba. And so everyone is struck by how much she resembles her, and Ko ends up getting close to her, and they sort of have feelings for each other, but not really, and stuff. And it's obvious from the beginning it's not going to happen. Like, I know that they're not going to end up together. Senda, obviously, not gonna end up with Alba. Mizuki, Alba's cousin, obviously, not gonna end up with her because she is, like, not interested in him from the beginning. They're going out on dates, and she still doesn't think that he's actually going to, like, a valid romantic partner. She's just doing it because she gets to go to a movie for free. And then he becomes a joke, too. He climbs up on stuff. And before, this was supposed to be his cool thing, because he's a mountain climber, and it's impressive that he can climb up stuff by himself. Then he ends up climbing up on stuff, and they're like, what are you doing up there? You look like an idiot. He's trying to impress girls by climbing up stuff, and they're like, I wouldn't be impressed if you did that. Well, then why was it impressive before? It just becomes a joke. Because he served his purpose as, for like, 5 chapters of being a danger to the Ko and Alpa relationship, but then eventually it's just like, no, obviously he wasn't, so he's just here now, not doing anything.
Yeah. Served his purpose.
And then Asuma, like, halfway through the series, is like, the only girl I'd actually be interested in is probably Alba. And you can't just get rid of him, because he is the cool, badass second ace of the team. But eventually you're just like, yeah, I still want Ko and Alba to end up together instead. It's just like, not... Apparently they're just fucking fated to be, and that's it. The only stuff getting in the way is, like, misunderstandings, because one thinks that the other is getting close to somebody else. And also, they're sin for each other. And that's it. Like, they don't get together because we have to maintain their current relationship, because that's the dynamic that was established in the beginning of the series, and that's what we have to run through, because that's what got... Until the very end. Because that's just how Mitsurudachi runs his series, is the relationship is pretty much the same all the way through until the last possible second, maybe it changes. Like, this, that, it, you're not even told, like, they like each other now. You're told they probably like each other now.
It's like 80% chance they're gonna get together. The end. Credits.
Well, it's an annoying thing. This is probably my least favorite thing that Adachi does, is it's not a matter of, you know, show, don't tell. It's a matter of show, don't imply, really. Because there will be these points where his characters are obviously going to get together, but we don't know for certain. So then at the end, in order to change the dynamic, he basically tells us, yeah, they probably got together. Bye! Yeah, the end!
Most likely did.
And that's basically what happens at the end, is there's this whole thing where, like, Ko and Alba basically hold hands at the end. And Alba thinks about how Ko said that he liked her, but only after asking her if it was okay if he lied. So she doesn't know if he's telling the truth, but they're holding hands, and they're like, hey, if you don't like holding my hand, then you don't have to. And then they're like, okay. They just keep holding hands. So they don't mind holding each other's hands, but they don't say anything. They don't hug, they don't kiss or anything like that. Because that's how we roll in a Dachiverse.
Dachiverse? It's like it's like the MCU, but far less interesting.
Well, it happened in Ruff, where basically the female love interest said, I'm going to get together with the winner of this race between my two love interests, but she knew it was going to be the main character. You don't get to see him win, you get to see the starting gun go off, and they start swimming, and then she says she knows that he's going to win. She's going to go out with him. Because she loves the winner. But the winner is going to be this guy. But you don't know it's actually going to be him, because you don't see the end of the race. For all you know, like, Derpy McDerpface, who we didn't ever see in the series, is actually going to win it. Some nameless guy who is one of the other 6 valid participants in the race might win it. And she'll end up going with some NPC instead of one of the 2 guys that was actually built up. For all you know. And that's just how it goes. It's like, do they like each other? Probably. Are they going to get together? Maybe.
Who knows?
That is why you read the rest of the series. It's because you ask the question, are they going to get together? And the rest of the series is for you to find out if they get together. I could have very well, in chapter 11, when I knew that Ko and Alba were the main couple, I could have gone, do they like each other? Maybe. Are they going to get together? Maybe. .. Read to find out is the implication in any romantic series, not read 170 chapters and then go, so did they get together? Maybe. Well, are you going to answer the question? Because you didn't answer it in 5 years of publication. Sometimes it's up to like 8 years of publication with this guy. And it's so fucking annoying. This is the third goddamn time this guy did this. And I knew it was going to happen, though. You didn't fool me. I knew this was going to happen. I read your book!
You fox, gotcha! So you got the advantage on him, Nick. He looks like the fool this time.
I mean, I don't like reading Adachi series because of this. It's because he does the same thing over and over again. It's so unsatisfying. I mean, I'll give the series this. It's really easy to read it, I think. It's not really challenging. It's occasionally, I think, pretty funny. If you have read Mitsuru Adachi's manga before, aside from this one, and you like his manga, and you don't think you'll get sick of it, then you should know this is definitely going to be good for you. It is the same stuff that he usually does, but it's got a little bit more of a dramatic, you know, hook to it. But it's easy to read. It's not challenging. It's light. It's not, you know, like, oh, you know, are they...
It's like the cashews of manga.
Yeah.
And the concept of eating them.
It's not very deep. It's fine. To actually read it is fine. If you are expecting a good payoff, it's a Mitsuru Adachi series. You're not going to get it.
There we go. Boosh.
Done. So yeah, that's it. You know, that's me talking about.
I will add, for my thoughts of last time, it is a really old-looking series that when I read it, I was like, I kind of just want to read The Rookies. That's my thought process. Yeah,
a better baseball manga is Chris's advice, and you know what? I will share it with him in it.
I will completely admit, 100%, that this was not my most insightful review or anything of that sort. I completely admit that. But it just, it was a series that aesthetically really did not do much for me. Yeah, ta-da!
Oh, I still got a lot of talking about that in, though. So I think that now we'll head into the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap. Yeah, that's a cross game, which is, from me, and I didn't read it from you.
Yeah, I read it, just, you know.
You read it, but you were like... I imagine you, like, holding the book in front of your face upside down as you're turning the pages and having the same reaction to it.
It was basically like, flip. Mm-hmm.
Yep, that flip. Happened. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I totally get that. I honestly really do. There were some points where I was reading this where I was just like, yeah, I guess that happened. I can gather what happened on this page as well. And this one, and... Oh, God! Where are they going to play baseball again? Fuck! Oh, it's over already! More of this bullshit walking around doing nothing!
I should have gone into it being like, I didn't care. I didn't really get to say much on this series during the recommendation. But probably my favorite, my wrong recommendation we've ever done. 10 out of 10. Everybody sure can like, just cut it there. Yeah, no.
How did Nick and Chris feel about the series? Did they like it? Did they hate it? Well, maybe.
Da-da-dun. Figure it out for yourself. It's like a Sopranos ending. We're not gonna tell you what happened.
I shouldn't have actually done the sum up.
Yeah, it was like, what do you think we thought about
what
it?
What do you think? Well, I gathered actually from what actually happened. In it. Well, then we gave you more than the manga did, didn't we? Okay, let's actually do the recap. Or should we do the manga recap now? Start with Black Clover. Page 28, Blackout, which opens with...
I completely forgot she existed, Nick.
Oh, God, what the fuck was this girl's name? I've completely fucking forgotten. So, the girl who snuck into the meeting, who chipified when she got excited about food, and said she was going to help out, but then got distracted because she wanted to get more food... She shows up in the kitchen where a chef is basically looking after his dish, which is on fire or something, and everyone's like, dude, let's abandon it, come on. And he's like, no, a chef cannot abandon his cooking in the middle and run, which leads us to our Black Clover Food Wars crossover, apparently. And everyone's like, oh, the knights are gone, nobody's here, it's a national emergency, we gotta go. And he's like, no, no. And then the girl comes in and gets on her hands and knees, like, that main course or whatever it is, let me eat it, please! And they're like, who is this? Wait, she's got a magic dice rope. And she's really determined to eat, I can tell by the look in her eyes. Okay, I'll make you the best main course you've ever seen. And she's like, yes! And all the other chefs are like, no, we should really leave. And this takes place over 3 pages. 3 pages were dedicated to, she's gonna eat.
I had a thought earlier today. If you change this series just slightly, it would be a One Punch Man-esque parody.
Really, yeah.
If you just made Asta defeating everybody like a practical joke, then this entire goofy-ass subcast would perfectly fit in with this.
Yeah, and this scene in One Punch Man would be perfectly fine.
Yeah.
As is, though, we have to go from this to, well, we sure beat some zombies, but Asta's still gotta take down the boss. Oh no, and the town is still in danger because of another source we didn't know about! We come into that from, I have food, yes!
food.
It's not even Toriko, where the whole series is about food. This is just like a random non sequitur. What the fuck? But yeah, we go into that to like, all of the other magic knights, except for Asta and Noelle and Leon, they're like, well, we sure beat some zombies, and a few of them are reacting like, oh, they were so gross. Sis! I can't believe that they tried to attack you! Yeah, oh, these are our character traits, guys. And everyone is celebrating that the Magic Knights have gotten rid of the zombies and stuff, but then the leader of the Silver Eagles is like, this is weird. Why did the enemy think they're unleashing creatures this week? Where, you know, why did they think of doing that? Where are the rest of them? But then the voice from darkness is like, ah, it looks as though they've all entered the marked areas. And we see Yuno's tome glows briefly before everyone's like, oh, they're after the king! But then, like, this black void opens up beneath all of them and teleports them all many kilometers away where they cannot be of any help. And so everyone's like, what the fuck? We've got to get back! Arr! Or rather, one of them just goes, curses! Which, that's fun, yeah. And yeah, the woman responsible, who's a very stereotypical-looking witch, actually. Like, you know, she's got the wide-brimmed hat and dark clothing and stuff. She just, like, is like, oh, they're so stupid! They all fell for the trap! Well, I was trying to play with the ones who escaped, but I guess it was pointless! And now I'll help myself to some nice young mana! And she just starts, like, draining energy from everyone around her. She doesn't even have to do anything. She just kind of, like, goes, you know, spreads her hands out and... Bah! And life's being sucked away from everyone. Very, very efficient.
Of course, we couldn't have her if she didn't have, like, a I'm beautiful gimmick.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, tell me I'm pretty. How old do I look? Tell me. And they're like, oh, you're a monster. Die!
I was really, like, I was firmly expecting this character when she comes up with that line of, like, I'm hungry for young mana. Like, I was really hoping she was going to come up with the line, like, I want young dudes. Men, I want them. Like, it takes
the witch costume off. It's Jirumi.
It was just such a, I don't know. I feel like we have to have more characters out there, like archetypes out there than this, right?
Yeah. Can't she be really obsessed with food instead? Yeah, like she's trying to get everyone away from the kitchen so she could force the chef to make the main dish for her.
Yeah, she's just, that's her entire plan. I'm going to get rid of all the strongest knights so that I can go to the kitchen and get all the sweet-ass food. And then I'll leave.
Bring me more cookies!
And then, again, this is the Black Clover parody series. Our heroes come to, like, do you know how many people died because of those zombies? And she's like, I never considered my plan could hurt people. Everyone's like, wait, you did this big, horrible, dangerous plan to get food and you assumed it was a victimless crime? Like, yes!
Cookie's never hurt anyone.
He just makes zombies. What was I supposed to assume that he would hurt people with them?
That's it. You're going to jail. No, you'll never take me. Wait, do they serve cookies in jail? Sometimes I think, okay, I surrender. Well, that was easy.
You finally caught Cookie Thompson.
Oh, so she's about to kill this guy who called her a monster, but a tornado suddenly snaps in between them, which apparently does nothing to harm either of them. It just kind of separates them because that's how mini tornadoes work, I guess. Magic.
It's, how do I put this, Nick? Very non-interesting that Yuno is the only one who seemingly didn't get pulled. I have to imagine Asta didn't as well, because...
Well, yeah, because that would have, I guess, teleported away her partner, I think?
Well, that would have also had to imply that Asta wouldn't be around to save the day, right. No matter what, but yeah,
We don't see Asta or Noelle with the people who were teleported away. I think that... because they say, oh, they're after the king, so presumably it was the plan for the other guy, Eyepatch Dude, to go after the king once everyone else was taken away. So.
Or I think maybe the zombie guy was to round them up into certain areas and then teleport them away, and then maybe there's a third person, Nick, who shows up
possible.
And comes after
that
the king.
That's possible, yeah. I get that, yeah. So, anyway... Witch Girl is like, oh, someone did escape the spatial magic, and it turns out that Yuno's glowy tome apparently warns him and allowed him to get away from this somehow. Not explained yet. And so she reacts to him by going, oh my, talk about gorgeous, you're just my type, Sasuke-kun, I mean Yuno. Yuno is your name, and not Sasuke. Yuno.
Yes.
Your own character. And so so she's like, you want to come do something fun with me? And Yuno goes, get away from those people, old lady. So did he hear her whole spiel before?
I feel like I need to be Bruce Timm instructing the guy who did the voice of Mr. Freeze for Batman Animated Series, Nick, where I'm like, no, less emotion, more dead. You need to be more dead when you read Yuno's lines.
Get away from those people, old
lady. Later. Less life, Nick. Less knife in your voice.
Get away from those people.
Oh, you're so close. I just need to take a look. You have a little bit of humanity still in your voice, Nick. I need to take that away.
Get away from those people.
Yes! Oh! I love when I'm handed clay and I mold it into the David.
So, yeah, apparently, you know, actually her, because she doesn't look old.
She doesn't, like, I didn't get where he comes up and he's like, get away from her old lady. I like to think, you know, he's just a rude dickhead and he says that to all women who are above his age.
Yeah, it's either that or he actually heard her whole spiel where she was like, do I look old? Tell me I'm pretty and stuff. And waited for her to threaten to kill the guy while draining mana from him to finally jump in after he had already seen her draining tons of mana from tons of people besides him. Dick you are, you know.
There's probably some logic, like, oh, the words are carried on the wind, so I can hear it, or some, like,
it took me a while
like
to
that.
Get here, but I have really good hearing, or some shit.
Or, like, maybe he's just a rude, like, asshole. Like, he's like, look, I didn't have parents, so fuck you. All women above my age are old ladies.
He's just a horrible sexist.
Yeah, he's just a big basket.
Yeah, actually, come to think of it, we haven't actually... really seen him interact with anyone other than Asta or his opponents or Hans, like, to this point, right?
I mean, we're left to believe that the only
way... Maybe he hates all women. He's just a tremendous misogynist.
Well, we only seen that he ever really knew one. I mean, there are probably, I guess, other girls
he just
in
knows,
the nursery.
He just
but...
knows the nun. So, maybe he's got a horrible virgin whore complex?
Yeah.
He's and damaged.
He is an awful person, Nick. And our only hope is that this... god-awful stereotype which defeats him and puts him in his place.
Yeah, he is reprehensible and needs to be stopped.
Yes, and then she can help herself to all of the buffet items.
Defeating a horrible asshole like Yuno makes her realize that all she really needed was food, not mana from innocent bystanders.
Yeah, justice, Nick. is what she needed to slake her thirst.
Oh, I love it.
Send this into fucking the Mangaka, and when he throws it back at us, we just start doing an illegal fan parody series. We'll call it something ingenious.
We'll do our alternate fan theory, like the very popular one about how Rusev is actually the babyface in WWE.
Yeah. We'll call it,
it's actually remarkably easy to do, honestly, when you've got him going up against assholes like Dolph Ziggler, or you know. So, yeah.
We'll call it Black Schmover.
Black Schmover.
I'll never be able to find
gray
it.
Gray Clover.
Because
there's room for Shades of Gray in our series.
Oh, yeah. Actually, let's call it Shades of Gray Clover, because then we can get the crossover audience for 50 Shades of Gray.
No, we're not doing
that. Are you sure? I can
easily insert
some softcore bondage into this.
Honestly, if we're having an alternate character interpretation for a woman who, like, grabs men by the face and goes, "Tell me I'm pretty," and asks young men if they want to do something fun with her, then we may actually have to do that, yeah.
I think this could work, Mick.
All right, let's bookmark it and put it aside for now for next week.
Put a pin in this.
Yeah. We now head into Bleach 641. Baby, hold your hand 4. I don't really merit.
Hashtag
four?
When I'm sleeping.
This title, Baby, Hold Your Hand, was so good, it has merited not only 3 sequels, but subtitles under 2 of those sequels.
They don't want you to get confused. They're like, so what Baby Hold Your Hand was your favorite? Like, definitely When I'm Sleeping.
And again, we're going to get into, like, Baby Hold Your Hand 5, Genesis.
I'm concerned, Nick, because at the rate Kubo is doing this, my next World Trigger to My Heart and Back Door needs to have an absolutely ridiculous subtitle for it to possibly compete
There's
with
no
this.
No way we can match up to this guy, man.
He is a genius at stupid titles.
So, anyway, we open with Nemu talking to now armless Mayuri, and she says, "I've got the flesh healing medicine. I stepped in so I could give it to you because I noticed that you didn't rummage through the medicine cabinet before heading to battle like you usually do. You didn't have a chance to do that." And Mayuri's like, "It's creepy how much you watch me." And she's like, "It's all your fault if I'm creepy. You programmed my every act."
She's like, "I literally have no choice in this scenario. Until you've recently taught me to do things that are different, I only do your will.
I am built, probably literally, to be the perfect assistant to you. You should be glad that I pick up where you leave off and help you when you overlook certain details. But you're instead acting like I'm the creepy one, Mr. I fucked my daughter, who might not actually be my daughter, who might be a reprogrammed corpse, or maybe I grew from scratch. I don't fucking know. In order to bring her back to life."
Bitch, you wore a son for the past 2 years of this story.
Anyway,
am I the weird one here?
So Mayuri jumps into the air to confront Perenita, and he, like, touches his feet so that they basically grow jet boots, essentially. Like, he modifies the whole Quincy walk-on-air thing, so he just threw around in the air and stuff. He dodges around freaking Quincy arrows as Perenita launches barrages and barrages and barrages of stuff at them, and so on and so forth. And he then apparently has a radio that he communicates with Nemu with, because I guess he really had to jump into action really quickly instead of them trying to hide and really plan. I don't know.
I like to think that he just recently watched a movie, Jupiter Ascending, and he's like, "You know what my favorite part of that movie was? Well, besides Channing Tatum being half wolf, it was the rocket boots. They were so cool. I'm gonna get rocket boots and I'm gonna fly around and I'll figure something out because I'm Mayuri. It's what I do."
You know my favorite part of Jupiter Ascending was?
What was it, Nick?
The fact that I didn't watch it.
You saved yourself a lot of time.
Saved myself an hour and a half and $10, or however high the admission price would have been. I don't know. Depends on what theater I would have gone to. Some, it's as low as $7, but, you know.
That's great, today's economy. Yeah. Nick, let's stop talking about Bleach. Let's really talk about today's economy and how people can save money.
You can subscribe to Shonen Jump instead of trying to buy the manga volumes one by one.
That is true. Pulling it away from manga even more, Sometimes if you go to Barnes & Noble, they'll have a 3-for-1 volume deal, so you can get 3 books. I guess this is still on manga. Guys, what we're saying is we have no actual life advice that doesn't pertain to manga.
You can actually treat Barnes & Noble as a library sometimes, because some of the books you can just read, and yeah.
The lesser popular ones, the ones you're really on the fence about, you can technically browse, see if you like it, read the first volume. If not, you know what? Don't keep reading. At that point, don't be a jerk.
Don't tell them to do that. Then they won't use our podcast in order to tell them what they should and should not read.
I'm just saying, read the first volume. If you don't like it, technically steal something else.
Technically steal something else.
Yeah, you're like...
Because you're reading it there instead of buying it.
Yeah, you're reading it there. You're like, all right, I'll move on to something else that I probably won't purchase, but I'm going to read it with the intention that I'm the noble spirit who may do it. And look, I've done that for a couple series myself. It's all right. Yeah, sometimes you have to make up for the money you spend on Flame of Recca.
Oh, no, I've never been kicked out of a bookstore for reading stuff there, so...
Well, aren't you just a saint?
I don't tend to go to Barnes & Noble very often, though, so maybe they just haven't gotten used to seeing me there, and so they don't know to post a "don't allow this man in" sign up or anything. Oh, God. Anyway, so Mayuri relays the plan to Nemu that I gave you a dagger thing fucking... I can nullify his arrows. I need you to stab the arrows because it will stop the nerves that are connected to the arrows, and then it will coagulate his blood flow and kill him, and I'm pretty sure he has blood. So just do that. I'll distract him, you stab the arrows that have the nerves running to them, and they will infect him with this blood coagulation virus thing, which works immediately. Blood!
It is like, wasn't that like a big thing of how fast his nerves could move, and like she stabs one nerve, and he's like, I've been foiled! Like, it's not even enough to be like, oh, well, I'll just detach my nerve from this arrow. It's to the point where it's like, oh, shit, my entire body's coagulated. Like, which is weird, because later on we see he does just rip off the finger that's being infected, but it seems like for the other ones, like, oh, it suddenly hit me way too quickly now.
Yeah. So, Pernita, basically, one of the arms goes down. Two of the arms actually go down, two of the three. But then the third one is going to be finished off, but he just rips off his own thumb to stop the coagulation from spreading. And then he goes, this ain't gonna kill me, Kuratsuchi. And Mayuri says, why is he talking like Zaraki? And then he's like, he's evolving by absorbing the information of everything he connects his nerves to. So presumably that's why he started talking all smart-like before, because he connected to Mayuri briefly. So that is why. So he imitates people close to him, and also we soon learn he can actually copy their abilities. For example, his reaction speed is similar to Zaraki's, so he's faster than Nemu. So he's like, "Oh, get away, Nemu!" But then, oh, he started copying Matai Fuku and Shotai's ability because Nerus can add to that too. And so he just shrugs off the damage that was done with coagulation. And it's like, oh shit. So, Pernita can basically do everything Gremmy did, but better.
Well, like, fuck, if, like, Gremmy, like, someone throw that brain in a jar up here, he fucking touches his nerve to that, can't he just have the same power? It seems like he has that ability.
Why hasn't they just used every ability so far? Why don't they just hook him up to everyone and have him use all their abilities? Why are the Quincy so incompetent using their own abilities?
Why are they so awesome yet also god-awful at being amazing?
I mean, I will say, I mean, to Kubo's credit, this chapter did convince me that Pernita is worthy of being considered like one of the top 5 Quincy's in his fucking army. Certainly a lot fucking more than
Najikoop was not part of his main army. He was defeated off-screen somewhere, if I recall correctly. It's Askanak Lavar who is.
Right.
And yes, he is super lame
I mean, this is easily the most impressive act we've seen from, I think, any of the Quincy so far. Is just being like, no, I'm fine. I copy your abilities, and I'm fine, and I grew more hands and stuff. This guy is actually pretty badass so far.
I just want a cutaway to someone else in Soul Society, like, looking over their shoulder, and they're like, are those a bunch of giant hands fighting? just be the fly on the shoulder watching this battle from the outside, like, what the fuck is happening here? Should I be concerned?
So, Anyway, Mayuri is distracted, telling Nemu to run away, because he thinks that when she's on the ground, oh, the nerves are going to get her. He doesn't see, oh, Prunia's fine, and also, it's going to crush me now. But we cut away from Mayuri apparently about to be crushed, to Nemu being like, Master Mayuri, Master Mayuri. Because presumably, he's in trouble. The only thing I can see from this panel is because it's such an awkward angle. First of all, her boobs are fucking huge. Second of all, what's wrong with her eyes? What is wrong with her fucking eyes in that picture?
Nick, it's what they call the uncanny valley. Science has reached an incredible point, but it can't perfectly capture the entire human body. So Mayuri, while being a very skilled scientist, hasn't managed to perfectly make a human being. It's in the eyes. That's where you can tell she's a freaky sex robot thing.
No, this is the first time we've seen this. We've seen her eyes before. They look so different.
It's just a weird Kubo drawing.
Like, her eye shadow's drawn completely differently. Her fucking her irises and pupils are in the wrong spots on her eyes for this drawing.
Well, one of the...
They're going in different directions, it looks like.
Yes.
It looks like one eye is flat and the other rounded.
Yeah, it actually does.
It looks so weird.
And also, there's a panel with just her eye where it's, like, exaggerated and stretched out. Maybe it's just the fact that we're seeing Nemu display an emotion of some kind, and that's what's... Maybe that was also just the problem. Koopa was like, I've never had her display an emotion before. What do I do? And he's just like,
I'll show her eyes looking weird because she can't facially react to it, so her eyes just kind of swim around on her face.
That is the perfect way to describe it. I just want to draw like little fishtails on them now.
If the next chapter opens with Nemu's eyes in that same position, and then the next panel, they're like drifting down, and the next panel, like one's on her cheek, and the other's on her chin or whatever, then I'll give full marks to this artistic decision. Until then, though, it's just like, God, that looks terrible and weird.
Nick, if the next chapter opens up and fucking Pernitas has smashed her into the floor like a fly, I would give this...
Like...
Look, and he's just squishing her against, like, ew! And then lifts her hand up and she's fucking dead. Oh my god, I'd be so happy. Because otherwise, I'm like, I don't care.
I won't be happy if Nemu's dead. I'll be happy if Mayuri's dead, though.
Oh, man. If either of them end up the next chapter... If next chapter starts, or ends, or at some point has the hand slapping the ground, and there's a giant smoosh sound effect, it will win all the points I can muster. It will be my number one title that week. With that, I don't care if fucking World Trigger has Osamu hijack back into the game and take out Ninomiya's squad and fucking Kagayari, just like fucking shotgun blast them both in the back end. I don't care.
And then they come back out and Kitora is there for some reason.
And she's naked.
Prolonged makeout session with Osamu.
Yeah. And fucking Bartolomeo shows up and he joins their fucking group, their new three-man squad. I would still give that Bleach chapter number one over that.
Yeah, it was, for the most part, I thought a pretty effective chapter for it was, but God, that last page is so stupid.
Yeah.
Do we have Fairy Tale this week?
It is going to be a live reading, because Fairy Tale...
Live reading of Fairy Tale!
Just came out. That's what happens when we do it on a Tuesday. It's basically debuting mid-show. So
Fairy Tale, chapter 451.
Fairy Heart. Our cover page is an image of, I guess, what the first guild looked like. And based on the black borders we're seeing at the start of this, it seems that we're still within the Mavis flashback.
Yes.
So it opens with Xerath carrying Mavis. There's a big panel up top that says a story thus far, but I'm not even going to try to zoom in to read that. And Hades is there, and whatever his name was before he became Hades. I'm just going to call him Hades. He's like, you're that black wizard who taught us years ago. What are you doing? Is that Mavis you're holding?
Nope.
Yeah, he's like, nope, just some corpse. What? He says, are you all alone? He's like, yes, everyone's making preparations for the Harvest Festival. We hear a serial killer is coming to town, and we're all going to become friends with him and point our hands up in the air afterwards, let him know we still care. He says that ever since Mavis vanished, he's had to take up the duties of the master. And Zara's like, good, well, here she is. And he just fucking, like, thuds her to the, he just plops her to the ground. He's like, here, take this crash.
It's such a great heel douchebag move. But it's also, like, in character for him, because, like, doesn't mean anything to me now.
It's a body. Yeah. Okay. Have this, blop. He says, this thing won't move again on its own. And this is before Hades became a super dick, so he's actually pretty concerned. He's like, Mavis, you were right. How can that monster do it to you? And Zareth just responds, yes, she's entered an eternal sleep. Good night, Mavis. But I suppose that if Mavis is a fairy, then perhaps I should be called Spriggan. I think it's a reference.
It's like an evil, ugly fairy type of thing.
Ah.
Well, the
he's kind of emo, Nick.
Yeah. Well, that's his like code name now in modern times, right? Spriggan.
Well, I can't hear Spriggan without thinking of Spriggan die Deutsch, which I don't actually know what it means.
Oh, right, wasn't there like the Spriggan 12 or something?
Oh, that's right. The Spriggan 12 was their name. The group with a bikini shrinky person.
Right.
Which, when I put those two things that were unrelated together, it makes it sound like she has a much more suggestive power than she actually does.
I shrink my own bikini to scandalous.
Yeah, I make beaches much more.
I'm the ultimate hero character. I make women's bikinis shrink. What if they're not wearing bikinis? They will be.
She's like, oh, my one weakness. Women who don't wear bikinis somewhere else than the beach.
How this happen in a hero series?
That's like her fucking Jaden from Yu-Gi-Oh! Thing. She has to like convince women that she meets and encounters outside of the beach to wear bikinis so that she can then shrink them and make them uncouth. Like, she's fighting the female Hitler. And she's like, I will never wear a bikini! She's like, but there's so many good styles out right now. Then, okay, I guess I shall have one. Oh no, you've made it disappear! I am so uncouth! And then
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Fucking bonks around that. I don't care if you have no idea, Nick. The theater in my mind is amazing right now. Alright, where was I?
Heard you say Jaden, I was like, what the... Dub GX Jaden?
Yeah, like, yeah, didn't he have the ability to just make shit happen?
Oh, like, okay.
Yeah, like, that's, like, her thing. Like, no matter how obtuse and wacky the scenario has to become for her to get women into bikinis so she can shrink them, she manages to find a way to make it happen.
Okay.
She just invents scenarios. She's like, but didn't you hear about the bikini jello wrestling match happening right now? Like, there's... No, it's
the women's titles on the line in this for some reason.
She's like, it's 100 degrees out. We're on a concrete floor. There's no way. And the jello field just appears. She's like, I'm compelled to. Why?
Whoop.
Anyway.
I'm shrinking now. Why I do this? Ah.
Okay, so.
Zerubbabel goes out for a little bit.
Yeah, he goes on his whole spiel. Love's a mistake. One I must never repeat. Hades picks up. Mavis picks her up, goes, takes her into the guild. He's like, I know we have a revivification. Is it revivification or revivification?
Revivification, I think.
Revivification. Like,
yeah, it would have to be that.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, okay. It should be in part of the guild's basement that's still under construction. And he puts her in there. He just puts her in the crystal that we presume is the same crystal she's been embedded
guys,
with the entire
happened
time.
To Mavis?
Yeah, he's like, don't worry about that, but don't walk into my basement because you may find a 12-year-old naked in a crystal. But that's it's
I'm not
for good
doing
intentions.
Anything weird to her. I'm just trying to bring her back from the dead.
Yeah,
she's not actually dead.
I'm a hero in this story until I'm inevitably my passion and desire for power lead me down a dark path. It's what all scientists do.
Also, I've got police tape for some reason. Keep it.
Yeah, I police tape. I sometimes wear a spiffy lab coat. I balance a lot of jobs on my shoulders.
I'm a Nick Fury cosplayer on weekends.
White Nick Fury because
comic
I,
book Nick Fury.
Yeah, original Marvel Universe Nick Fury. I know there's two now.
I know there's Ultimate Universe, and then they based his appearance off of.
I have heard they've combined universes, thank you very much. Original universe. It still means something.
Hashtag original universe still means something.
My Spider-Man is Peter Parker, okay? That's what I'm saying. And it's not a race thing, just because the two characters I happen to mention were mine were white.
Just, you know.
I think that Miles Morales is fine. It's just that Peter Parker is the Spider-Man I grew up with.
Yeah, it's you years. Kids can have your wacky gangster spot. Shit, damn it. I shouldn't have taken those speech classes from Donald Trump. I really shouldn't have.
And some Spider-Men, I assume, are good people.
Yeah, I bet there are a lot of them that don't rob people. Damn it!
Well, he wears a mask. You can't trust him.
I'm just saying, you know, hip-hop variant covers coming out. Spider-Man is black.
I never trusted that Luke Cage, damn it.
Yeah, this is going to win. I'm going to lose so many points with the Avengers.
I'm just saying, this is why Steel failed as a movie.
Some guy like in the back's like, well, maybe it's because Shaquille O'Neal played him. You shut up, Shaquille O'Neal is an acting saint.
He hates all black people except Shaquille O'Neal.
He's awesome. What the fuck are we? Holy shit, is this what happens when we have a live reading? Hades goes on to explain a bunch of bullshit about what he's doing now. All the revival things he tried to do.
I'm trying to revive her, but it's not working.
Yeah,
but he's still alive, kind of, but not really, sort of. I don't know. And that's why I'm still here, guys. And that's the whole story, fairy tale.
Now you know that part of the story. Now, he basically told everyone eventually that Mavis died so he could try to figure it out. They built the whole graveyard for her and everything like that. He was declared a second master, blah, blah, blah. Makarov's father passed away, never knowing the truth about his wife's death. Oh, because, okay. I was like, for a moment, I was like, wait, was Mavis his father? Her mother? I was confused for a moment. Now, blah, 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 nearly 30 years, Hades kept trying to revive me, but those efforts took an unexpected turn. His rare knowledge and skill, as well as his genius and the preservation of my otherwise immortal body, proved to be a dangerous combination. It gave rise to a magic that still beggars are you really justifying this dude's evilness as, like, a byproduct of fucking your super life magic? Can't anyone in Fairy Tale just, like, be a good guy who turned evil and didn't really get redemption at the end?
Well, they more focus on just the creation of fairy art than anything else. Which, by the way, gets a full panel of Mavis saying, "Fairy heart."
Also, if Nimue had some fucked up eyes, holy shit, Mavis's eyes are encompassing, like, 80% of her face right there.
Yeah, but that's at least normal, weird anime eyes.
Yeah, I guess so.
As opposed to, like they would be Nemu eyes if they were, like, all squinted up and swinging around. And at least her eyes are in the proper place for her character model. Anyway.
So, yeah. Let's see here. Just as the name suggests, it's eternal, limitless, a source of magic that will never run dry. Blah, blah, blah. Therian. Fairyheart.
Basically, yeah, it is the ultimate power source. It could be used to do anything infinitely.
Okay, so essentially a non-ending nuclear weapon of sorts.
Right, so Makarov at one point actually explains, like, you know, I thought about using it at one point, but we have no idea what would happen if we actually unleashed it. I mean, what if we can control it after, you know, taking the letting it out, basically.
Elfman asks the important question of, like, well, you know, they're going to attack us because they want Fairy Heart. Mira Jane's like, well, they already have so much power themselves. They have the bikini shrinking woman and everything. And Mavis explains, it's like, because they needed to defeat Actologia, the apocalypse dragon. He's one of the few things in Xerath's way. So they're saying that they can't defeat Actologia without it. I'm gonna take a wild stab here, Nick. I bet friendship could beat that dragon.
Well, it's interesting because Happy is like, sorry if this sounds stupid or something, I was like, but why don't we use it to defeat Elbrus, or whatever it's called, and Acnologia? And then they're like, because we couldn't control it. And he's like, sorry for asking. I was like, Happy, that's the smartest thing you've ever said. Don't feel bad. That's a valid question.
It's as like, you see a head slowly pulling in from the side, Frosh agrees.
No, Mike, I'm serious. Like, you know,
Happy, no, it is a great question.
Yeah, Happy's like so down himself for even like bring it up, and then when they get asked the question, it was like, we couldn't control it. He's just like, I'm sorry. Like, no, that's a good question. You've got this awesome power source. You need to be told why you're not using it in order to make it to, you know, fight these important battles. You can't win. You're not sure if you can win otherwise. It's good.
I mean,
I'm surprised Happy asked it.
I'm glad Happy asked it. It's an important question. It's honestly a question I feel is so important, it deserves more than the one-panel explanation Makarov used to justify it. I can understand his logic. He's like, look, it's one of those things, you use it once, and then you constantly have to justify not using it again. Like, what's to keep us from using it the next time something big happens?
Or even like, you know, what would happen after it had served its purpose to us? Would we be able to stop it? Mm-hmm. What would happen if the power was constantly flowing out? You know, it could wreak mass devastation and so on and so forth. And this is something you could be like, you know, dedicate panels to of like theoretical events of like, you know, giant vortexes of power ripping the landscape apart and stuff like that. Instead of Margaret just like, no, we can control it.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand in the sense it's like it's too unwieldy to control. But definitely if it's just the idea of like, oh, you know, like we, you know, one person, you know, once you go use it, we can't, you know, what's to keep the temptation of man from using it again. I also just want one dude in the guild to be like, you know, not for nothing, this would really help us out. Like, I don't know, give it to Elfman. You made him an asshole every other fucking, like, you made him asshole last arc by making him evil and shit. Why isn't he just like, you know, why don't we just do it once? I mean, we're a pretty smart guild. I'm not saying he needs to be right. I'm just saying, let's make this like Civil War. Let's throw some opposite side in here. Let's get some pro-reg.
No, that would involve there being a dispute in Fairy Tale, dude.
Yeah, that's true. That Fairy Tale members would have to have a disagreement over something that isn't the fucking whose drink did you just spill? Or
do you know how that would actually actually go down? Like, one of them would like actually secretly get the whole thing, the whole like separate side together, and then Natsu would say, "We're Fairy Tale, and we believe." And then we would be like, "Yeah, you're right," and they would just get back together and hug and stuff.
Yeah.
It would go through all the build up and then immediately be diffused and stuff.
And then actually, wacky,
but God, you know, I mentioned, you know, I was like, oh, you could show panels of like theoretical events of like this devastation fairy heart could wreak. I would have preferred that to Mavis saying, oh, I'm so guilty that my sins wrought this, and everyone being like, no, it's okay. Again.
Yeah, so she says, this magic came from my wrongdoing. I had always hoped it wouldn't bring harm to the guild. And strangely enough, well, strangely if only because this didn't seem like his thing, but when you think about it, it is his thing.
I got a call.
So, Gajio pops in with saying, I don't get what's wrong with loving somebody else. Ain't no arresting anybody for that. I don't know why he's a fucking cowboy, but he is in this. And everyone's like, what? It's not, you're supposed to eat metal and punch people. And you're like, no, he's actually like the one character in Fairy Tale seems to be accepting the fact that he's in a relationship of some kind. But yeah, everyone then proceeds to basically fucking like the end of Neon Genesis Evangelion. They're just like, no, we like you, Master. You're a great guy. You know, if it wasn't for you, I'd be lost. Like, congratulations, man. And they all start clapping for her and shit. And then everyone angrily stops watching the show. Now, she starts crying. Basically, everyone just talks how fucking awesome she is. Even fucking Makarov's just like, you created an excellent guild. And then Siegfried and whatever the fucking other guy's name is. Bixlow. Okay, yeah. The two guys who we found out are like weird pedophiles are the only ones who don't congratulate her, I guess. They note that Xerath himself is immortal, so how are they supposed to hurt him? So Natsu responds with, you leave that part to me! And he jumps up on the table and he flexes and says, I can take Xerath down! I got a secret plan for that right here! And
well, the secret... He's indicating his arm specifically.
Yes. I'm gonna guess, Nick, his secret weapon is punching something.
Well, I think that it's implying, because he's had it bandaged up since the time skip, that there's actually something different about it.
Hmm.
Which I am surprised, and actually, you know, pleasantly surprised, because, I mean, we didn't make any notes, like, oh, he's got a bandage on his arm now. It's just like, oh, okay, whatever, you know, just, he looks a little different, but not really, you know. So if this was actually something that was put in place beforehand, it's like, oh yeah, you know, there's this little character tweak, and it actually serves a purpose. Well done, hero. I like that. Putting it there, but not like being like, oh, his arm is important from the very get-go, you know.
Yeah. So that was Fairy Tale.
Yeah.
I can't tell if I like the chapter now, because I don't remember anything besides our random tangents.
Well, I mean, I like the bit where Gajeel is the one to be like, no, it's not, there's no, you just fell in love, no one's going to blame you for that, or something like that. It's like, that is a surprisingly mature thing for him to say. And I like that. I like what we've been seeing from Gajeel since the time skip, and I hope to actually see more from him as time goes on, which means that we won't. But, you know, how dare I have hope, right?
Yeah.
But in general, like, just having that whole thing where everyone's like, it's okay, Mavis, we don't blame you, it's not your fault. It's like, you did the same thing with Makarov a few chapters ago. And also, Mavis has had 100 years to deal with this guilt, and she's only just now being told, it's okay, it's not your fault. Come on.
I would like to think she's been hanging out with the guild and, like, watching all of their friendship for, like, the past, like, 3 years, and she's still like, oh, they're never going to forgive me for loving somebody.
Just hanging out in the corner.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She's like, nobody will like
this that. Is why it took so long for her spiritual form to actually come out and help them and stuff like that. It took her a long time to work up the nerve.
Yeah,
she was thinking of being the strategist for, like, the 90 years before that, too.
But, yeah, she's been hanging out in the corner. She's, like, watching Hades go evil. She's like, I should say something. Oh, what if he doesn't like me?
She sees Laxus planning his revolt, and he's like, oh, I shouldn't let this happen.
There's literally,
I should really tell him about that time that everyone holds their hands up and stuff. Everything will work out.
There's literally a button across the room that's like, if she presses it, it'll stop Laxus from being evil. But she's like, oh, there's people in the room. They'll see me if I come out.
I'm too shy.
I bet they'll get it.
I could stop them from destroying the guild, but oh no. I'll just hide in the rubble and sneak out before they rebuild.
I'll just sit here and listen to my music. Oh, I'm scared. These guys
are playing a little bit of sad Charlie Brown music as she sulks up.
Oh my god. This is Christmas time has come.
It's got the sad note to it, remember, when he's like, you know, leaving the theater and stuff? Yeah.
I like the thing she listens to.
In fairy tale, it might as well always be Christmas fucking time.
Or she just listens to Christmas music during non-Christmas season. She's like, I like to be a freak.
It's the only thing that makes me feel happy. Sometimes.
It's fucking July and she's walking around in her fucking guild like, rum-pum-pum.
Like, Davis, why are you listening to Christmas? It's July. Yeah, it reminds me of the Christmas in July cartoon specials that would run.
Oh, the good old days. Cartoon, you kids cartoon. Today.
Oh, I miss cartoon Fridays.
I miss Time Squad.
Oh man, Time Squad was fucking
great. It was such a great show.
Eli Whitney with his fucking flesh-eating robots.
They had a gay robot on the show.
Well, he wasn't said to be gay, but
seriously. He had a gay party at one point with a bunch of other gay robots dancing around.
At one time where they had to go and help the Earl of Sandwich, but he got distracted because he wanted to run a souffle restaurant.
I just want to know, we haven't finished the fairy tale recap yet. We're still talking about fairy tale. Mavis sure looks stupid with that one panel with her eyes really open. I just want to make sure Infamous Planet has to go out when he does the omnibus version, so he has to find an episode of Time Squad.
It was that one time. The fucking Nobel made the Nobel Prize for the greatest awful human beings in history, so like fucking Lizzie Borden and Jack the Ripper were there. They had an epic fight scene with them.
Why did that show not go on for like 8 years?
That was amazing. I can't believe that ran when it did. That seems like it should have run like on Adult Swim or some shit.
It was a ridiculously awesome show.
That would be an amazing Adult Swim show. And it ran when Adult Swim was on. I can't believe it was running a cartoon. It was great. It was. Oh god, I miss Time Squad. Gonna watch more of it as soon as I'm done with this. Anyway. I believe now we'll move on.
Yeah.
Well, now that I've managed to name drop three different episodes.
And you didn't even mention the one where Beethoven becomes a professional wrestler.
Oh my god, it's fucking great! Professional wrestling reference! I completely skipped my mind too. But what was that, Baron on Bronebreaker or some shit like that? Oh, great episode. And they made a callback to it too. That and like when the Founding Fathers were like just tremendous frat boys when they drank coffee, and that's what made them start the Revolutionary War.
All right,
five episodes, yes!
Nick, all right. We'll start up a Time Squad podcast after this.
I'd fucking do it. Food Wars! Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 133, A Dinner Table Swallowed by Shadow. So, getting back to that whole storyline where Erina's father showed up unannounced, which we completely didn't touch on because we had to touch on their... Oh, God, I've forgotten his name completely. I forgot...
Tsukasa?
Yeah, I forgot his title, though. Der Weiss.
The White Knight of the Table.
Der Weiss. There we go. I was told I shouldn't yell when doing German. But
it makes it aggressive.
Der Weiss, Richter Tafel. That sounds better. Okay, so...
You're like, my only reference to Germans is sadly the Nazis, and they kind of shouted a lot of things.
Okay, so we get a flashback from Erina, which gives us a bit more insight into her relationship with Soma's father, where basically she was like, oh, when I grow up, I want to be a great chef like you. Will you come and taste my cooking that someday? And he was like, oh, all right, one day, once you become a great chef, I'll gladly try what you've prepared. Tasting your dishes is a pleasure. I'll wait until that day to enjoy. It's like, oh, that's sweet. He was being nice to a little girl, and she followed her dreams because he encouraged her. Aw.
Nick, what adult inspired you in this way?
I guess I haven't had that moment yet, Chris.
Do you want me to be that moment, Nick? Like, you put on a beanie, and you know, you're like, sir, can you help me turn on this calculator? And I'm
like... Here you go. Image of children these days, they wear beanies.
And I turn on your calculator, I'm like, here you go, son, when you become a great accountant. Oh, God, I'm asking you to do my taxes.
This is like, Chris didn't come this day either. I guess that means I haven't become a great accountant yet.
Every tax season, you keep a seat open at your desk for me to show
sir,
up.
Don't you think we could take more customers on if we had it, if we didn't allow that test to be taken by another customer?
You're like, if you respect my accounting work at all, you'll never ask me such a stupid question again!
Now get out, Mendez! No. When I open my own accounting firm, I hire someone named Mendez so I can keep them out constantly. Sir, my name isn't actually Sako.
Where were we?
Anyway, so yeah, Erin is like, oh, it hasn't come this time either. That must mean I'm not gonna fit, which is a really fucked up way of taking the situation. It's like, it might just mean that, like, he hasn't made the time yet. It's okay. But she, like, is keeping herself, you know, optimistic. It's like, one day he'll come. But this is just a push home. Yeah, that table that she kept open, it is for Saiba Yukihira. But, anyway, her father has arrived in all black with his one white streak of hair adjusted in his tie, jacket flaring out. And it's like, oh, it's her father is here. And Hisako is like, the restaurant's by reservation only, so you can't. And he just, like, comes in, barges in, walks past them, and looks around at everyone, and he's like, Erina, your cooking is not meant for this plebeian crowd. You should choose your customers more wisely, my darling. Commoners such as these are a disgrace to your nobility. And everyone's like, So one of the Academy sponsors is like, oi, you there, boy. You have any idea who you were talking to when you decided to open your fat mouth?
I'm like, when did Gav get in the series? Oh, wait, that one has a nice job. That can't be Gav.
And he's sitting at a table with a culinary author and essayist. And so it's like, hey, boy, speak up, I can't hear you. And they're like, oh.
When did Infamous Planet get in this manga?
He's like, sir, you really shouldn't talk that. What are you mumbling about back there? Speak so I can hear you. It's Erina's father. Oh. And so the guy, having realized who he is like, he was supposed to have been banished from Totsuki years ago. I'm just going to go between these, like, four different accents I've chosen for this guy over and over again. But yeah, Hisako actually fills us in via flashback to when she once read an old issue of a particular culinary magazine in the Institute's library. Which one? A particular culinary magazine. A culinary magazine. Shut up. It was a good one, though.
Yeah, it was just the one that didn't happen to have been burned that gave her the important information she needed.
So, anyway, yeah, every other photograph of him anywhere in the Institute had long since been confiscated. And
it was the MacGuffin times. Sorry, go ahead.
And back in his heyday, he wore an ascot. That's all I want to say. But Hisako, we actually also get a brief glimpse of her father, too. And he's in the shadows, too, so you can't see his face. He wears glasses. That's all we really know about him. So a lot of different father figures getting kind of touched on in this chapter, and I really like that. You know, just being like, oh, here's this kind of like previous generation of all these people, and this you can see in a few cases why a bunch of different characters turned out the way they were, because they had this influence on them.
Now, I was going to ask, as I've mentioned several times before, there's still a couple volumes of the series I need to catch up on, and I will. Stop saying I won't. I will. Just take a moment.
I have faith.
My Kindle's...
It took me a long time, but I did.
Yeah. My Kindle's currently fucked up. I'm trying to wait until I can get that fixed up or buy a new one. Anyways, has this girl's father shown up before in any sort of influence? Nope. Is this the first time? And I know they shadow out his face. I feel like it's to do something, you know, use him at some later point.
Yeah, it seems like he's going to be important later.
I mean, she was one of the five girls featured in that Chinese dress thing. So maybe
this is fourth or fourth. She's actually a fairly important character after that whole thing where, you know, because she was used in the tournament. She lost in, like, the first round of the finals, I think. She lost to Hayama. She also had that whole thing during the...
Stagiaire week.
So she's becoming a more important character in her own right. So her guardian being introduced, yeah, it's not outside the realm of possibility, I don't think. Anyway, but... Very importantly, Hisako says, you know, because she asks him, I guess after having learned about this, or maybe she was younger, who knows? It's hard to tell, because she's got, like, this weird short hair length in both, and it's hard to tell if she's older or younger in one of the other flashbacks. But she asks her father, does Erina not have a father or mother? And she's like, don't ever talk about Erina's father. Don't ever ask about him. Just... Her legal guardian is Senzaemon, who's, you know, the academy head, you know. That's all you need to know, okay?
Never speak his name three times in the mirror.
Yeah. And so, yeah, basically it's just like, no one talks about him. There's no records on him or anything. He did something...
Don't feed him after midnight. You just start adding arrhythmias to him.
He did something, apparently, that was so terrible that he was basically banned for life. And we don't really know what that is, but he is a bad dude.
If you follow WWE rules, he had to murder his entire family or say the N-word, so...
Or murder his girlfriend.
Yeah. Allegedly. Yeah, so,
Allegedly.
Allegedly murder his girlfriend,
No, the jury is actually out on that one now. It wasn't out for, like, 20 years. Took you long enough, but it happened, yeah. Anyway, Erina is, like, in shock, basically, right now. She... is trembling, and Hisako's like, are you okay? Why is she so scared? But then she's like, and where's he been? What's he been up to? Why is he here now? As we get a full on, you know, title, his name in a little caption box, Azami Nakiri, Erina's father. And so he's been walking around, and two girls who are, like the owners of this prepackaged curry company or something. They're like,
Oh my god, why is everyone so terrified?
You come stomping into a fine dinner like a rampaging bird and start talking about the no one, and you call us unsophisticated birds?
Oh, that's one, sister. She's the one who smokes more.
Right. So Azami says, the lady executives of the most successful company in prepackaged curry. How there's business schlepping that puerile slop of yours across the globe. Like, saying it with, like, a smile, but it's a totally gritting teeth smile. It's like, God, this guy's a douchebag. Like, we'll just call you an ugly motherfucker to your face while grinning ear to ear. God. So, yeah, they get really pissed off about this. And they're like, oh, we're sponsors of the Tosuke Institute. Yo, if you insult us, you insult the entire Tosuke name. And he says, that is why I have come, to return it to its true glory, to the way it was meant to be. All of you claim to be experts in fine dining, but I wonder how many of you truly understand real gourmet. True gourmet. It is high art, much the same as fine paintings, sculptures, and performances. The true value of any artistic masterpiece can only be appreciated by those chosen few of proper breeding, talent, and upbringing. The rest, he turned to the Elmer Fudd halfway through, the west of the unwashed mantis simply crowd around what their betters have deemed of value, ooing and awing over it with no actual comprehension of what it is.
He turned to Elmer Fudd or Barbara Walters.
Alright, I'm back. True gourmet is precisely the same. It is meant to be displayed only to those select few who can truly grasp its greatness. That is fine cuisine. Anything else isn't cuisine. It isn't even food. It's fodder. Done in, like, this, like... It's like he's gone to the fucking negative zone. There's so much... Like, he looks like a statue in a rundown room. There's so much black... use on the panel.
I feel like if you replace the text here, you could easily replace this with a scene from Six in Majitan to Megami Nero. Just one of those, like, oh my god, this dude
looks like he has just killed someone. Honestly. Yeah,
this is the embodiment of evil.
So yeah, he's like, oh, and you lot who mistake simply using fine ingredients as fine dining, you are truly incapable of understanding that, I'm afraid. And everyone's like, oh, you guys are insulting me. You don't have... Yeah, you know, you don't have... You're just, you know, spouting hot air. You don't have the tiniest scrap of authority to dictate policy of Tatsuki. And he says, oh, really? My flesh and blood is yet present within it, and she has the proper education. Come, Erina, my darling. It has been 10 years since I first taught you how to cook properly. I want you to show me how much your skill has grown. And Hisako's like, you don't have a reservation. You can't. And she's just like, oh, but I see an empty table right over there.
You can't take that table. I farted on it. Now I'll get him out. So, saved it.
So yeah, Erina starts a protest, and she's like, you know, that table, father, that table's... He just walks past her, doesn't let her finish, and she remembers one last time the promise that she made to Yukihira as he takes the seat and sits down and says, I will view your wine list first. And she just stares in complete shock at him, like the life's like gone from her eyes. And he says, do you intend to keep me waiting? Your father is hungry. He would like to eat something now. So this panel got sent to us with the question of, did he like sexually abuse her or something? Is this going to be freezing again? There's no fucking way it's going to be freezing again. I will admit, though, that is a very creepy and off-putting panel, and it is this is an incredibly effective chapter at building this guy up as the most horrible, creepy, unsettling person when all he really does is insult people. We don't know what he did. We don't know what he does now. We just know that he has done something that makes everyone hate him.
That's the thing, like, Shokugeki no Soma is at its best when it's being very absurd and how much it dedicates itself to this series. This dude's entire thing is like, y'all fucking cooking ain't great. Like, it's bullshit. As good as it is, it ain't nothing. And, like, he's doing this as, like, this creepy thing, like, I want your food. You're going to keep me hungry. And it's very effective. It's drawing this very, you know, incredibly visual and just encapsulating way. And at the same time, in my mind, I'm like, I'm also recognizing that it's almost like a hidden layer of parody here. And, like, this is the most evil motherfucker in Jump right now. This entire thing is like, well, like I want food!
Who's he fucking competing with? Like, let's see, Joey, Juhibak, well, there's no real villain, because we're in between arcs in One Piece.
Mm-hmm.
And
Stain's just been defeated.
Stain's just been defeated, so we're in between villains in My Hero Academia.
As the cat, like the villain group they set up this week, but it is just like this dude's like our like
he's being set up as, like, this evil motherfucker, and you're like, his biggest crime thus far is telling a fat old dude to go eat better food or stuff.
He's just being snooty towards already snooty people.
Yeah, he's just like, get wrecked, pleb. GG easy, and fucking licks his tears off. It's his big crime thus far. But it is just the way it's drawn, the way it's portrayed is just... It's terrifying. And another series is, you know, easily could be the exact same thing to suggest something as horrible as that. This is Shogunkinosoma. I don't think that's the situation at all, but it is just something that you're like, wow, this dude is terrifying based off these, like, two pages.
And he, like, breaks Erina, like, immediately. Because she immediately stops objecting and is going to prepare food for him. She's like, yes, sir, and she's going to do it. And... It's really effective because we've never seen anything remotely resembling this side of Arina's character before, because she's been built up as this pretty haughty, holier-than-thou person, not nearly to this guy's degree. And she's very judgmental, and she has difficulty expressing herself to other people, but then he just, like, turns her into this, like, little girl all of a sudden. And then the door opens, and Soma's there because he wants to eat.
Oh, he has a pork bun. Fuck, I need a pork bun. God damn it.
I love the two pages where he arrives, because, you know, we just see the door open. We see Izako look over Arina's shoulder to see who's there. Her face lights up with relief. We see his hand on the door first. She turns around as he greets her, and he's just there. He's like, you got an open seat? And Arina's there. She's still looking scared. And then we go over to Izami's reaction, and he hates Soma. Like, we have no idea why. The only thing that we get is that Arina says Yukihira. So, presumably, not only is there a deep connection between Arina and Soma's father, but there is probably a connection between both of their fathers. And apparently, they don't like each other.
Nah.
It's amazing how much, like, just those two panels, like, well, I guess three panels can say so much. She says a name, he turns and looks, and you just see his eyes. And he's had these, like, same, like, pupil-less, just giant black, or, like, giant black irises.
They're not, like, completely black, but there's only just enough white for you to tell that they're supposed to be a normal person's eyes, but the shadow just keeps it from giving you anything that would still feel human.
And he looks down on everyone and stuff, but he hasn't actually let it affect his expression, and he's just narrowing his eyes at Soma, like, oh, this motherfucker.
The kind of glare that would... literally kill people. like I would literally be like, I'm all right, this dude's gonna do something bad to me, I'm gonna save myself the time and just put my head in this front and just boil my head alive, because this is, I don't want to deal with that one bit. And you find out he's just like, I'm gonna make you a popcorn that's going to blow your mind. I'm like, oh, I definitely shouldn't have checked out so early. But no, this was a really good chapter of Food Wars. I enjoyed every aspect of it. I love this new character. I love we're kind of getting built up for him. I've completely forgotten about last chapter having a whole, like, oh, it ends on this one panel leading up to this story. Like, that's something that maybe I'd notice again when I'm reading the volumes, but this chapter alone was just so effective at building up a big threat. Maybe, you know, maybe this is a final antagonist kind of character, you know. He definitely certainly has that aura to him. I feel like this is something we're going to be seeing in the series going forward, and I'm very excited. He's a great, great preview of this character. And not enough can be said about the artwork. Artwork's incredible.
This is how you introduce a villain. Fucking take note, everyone. He's snooty about food, and he's awesome.
Yeah, I was like, fucking, how many villains are like, I'm gonna make a dude who wants to take over the world. This dude's just like, no, I want less people to eat food from chefs who can make better shit, because you're all fucking goobers and can't appreciate the food. That's his entire motivation as we've seen it thus far, and he's still, I'm like, oh my god, this monster. I'd be like, no, Yuubak, he can do whatever. He half his army is like a hand and a brain in a jar. It's bullshit. But this dude, he doesn't want us to have good food. He's calling us goobers. So yeah, I'm pretty excited for this dude.
Alright, let's move on now to My Hero Academia number 57, The Aftermath of Hero Killer Stain. And we get a couple of pages that are basically just, like, the public fighting
the aftermath of Hero Killer Stain, yeah.
Yeah, they just, you know, a reporter is like, oh, what's going on here? And they get reports of, oh, you know, Stain was arrested, and, like, a a special newspaper comes out. We see Stain done up in all these, you know, heavy-duty bonds. There's a little interview featured with Endeavor where he takes credit for it, all according to the plan from before. There's talking heads discussing the Nomu very briefly. And
it has, like, an alien horn.
Yeah.
I guess that's maybe it's as quirky as horns. One of them's broken off.
Or, well, maybe he's just got the one horn. Well, no, wait, one is broken. Yeah, you can see the stump right there. Yeah. Maybe he's a former hero.
Nick, they've added such little detail to this character that now I'm very interested in what his entire life and backstory is. I'm going to message Hiroshi right now.
That's just completely negate everything that we talked about, praising Food Wars. Like, look, it's just one panel. The guy
I'm like, hold on, I need to send a letter. Dear Horikoshi Sensei, what the deal with the... Well, I fucking write like an idiot. Like, what the deal with the TV reporter with the one broken horn?
You know what I'm saying?
That shit seemed weird, but it all right.
Yeah, son. So we get basically Hand and Face Guy reacting to this news, and they're like, oh, God, I wanted to make the world forget about him. And now we're the sideshow. They barely even discuss the Nomu. Fuck you, Stain.
You jerk.
And we cut to...
the pants guy.
We cut to Best Genist, who is with Bakugo. We find out they apparently spent the whole time just combing Bakugo's hair to like his.
It explodes like a bomb anyway.
With the sound effect bomb.
And they just note that his entire, like, contingent of people have the catchphrase, "Let our tight jeans keep our bodies and minds bound upright."
And Bakugo's just like, "I came to the wrong place." And then we cut... we actually get a few other reactions going on, too. Like, oh, we missed... I'm glad that I passed on that SOS location thing that I got. And we see the fucking demo for the commercial that the two female students shot with their, like, semi-idol superheroine. Oh, God. And then we cut to Uraraka, who's talking on the phone with Deku. And he's just like, oh, hey, I've got to go do basic training, so I'll talk to you later at school and stuff. And her instructor is like, oh, was that a love interest? No, it wasn't. And we cut back to Deku, who's like, I talked to a girl on the phone.
Awesome. Also, I can't remember what the robot dude's name is, but...
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
I don't remember, but I just like the idea that he like just slides up to her and she's talking. He's just like, you're so beloved. It's like in this big goofy like robot mask with these enormous hands. He's like, oh, do you have a crush? Beam, beam, twinkle, twinkle.
He's like, no, that you're misunderstanding the point. Miro Deku's like, I talked to a girl on the phone. Well, I just remember that he had that weird way of talking where he's like, you know, this is the way that I behave. Okay? You know, I treat everything seriously. You got a problem with that?
I love this character now. I need to look this up and figure it out.
Yeah. So Deku goes back into the hospital room that he shares with Todoroki and Ida. And there's actually some really bad news that Ida has where he's like, you know, my left hand could have permanent damage because both my arms are badly injured, but my left arm got the worst of it. I've severed something called the brachial plexus nerve, and I might regain what's the feeling and use my fingers if I get a nerve transplant, but you know, but it's pretty bad. You know, I should have told Manuel before I did anything, but I wasn't, you know, he wasn't wrong scolding me and stuff, and until I succeed in becoming a true hero, my left hand will serve as a reminder. So presumably he's actually going to deliberately like handicap himself until he lives up to his own standards, I guess. So maybe this is the consequences. He's talking about maybe.
Boss, it's at least interesting that there is some kind of consequence to this event. You know, even if it's just something small, it's like I may not have full use of my hand from here on forward. That's a huge impact, you know. And this doesn't seem to be a series. Well, I mean, we know that there are healers in the series, but the fact that they're noting, like, oh, it may not get better, I mean, that means something, you know? It's if that's actually a permanent thing that lasts in this series, that he's going to be handicapped from here going forward, even if it's, you know, it's not like it's as major as, like, oh, my ankle gives out on me every so often, you know, he can still fight, but just the sense that there's some kind of cost to this is pretty impactful.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Deku thinks about actually apologizing, like, nah, that'd be insulting, you know. This hand will be my guide. And he holds out his clenched fist towards Ida. He's like, let's get strong together. But Todoroki sees the scenes, and he also apologizes. And he's like, whenever I'm involved, it feels like people's hands get messed up or something. Like, what are you talking about?
Well, then even, like, the other two are like, holy shit, he can make a joke. And I'm like, I don't know if he was making a joke. I feel like he's super serious.
No, I'm not joking. Call me the hand crusher. The hand crusher!
It's my curse.
Yeah, people's hands get injured around.
It's my third secret quirk.
Third secret quirk. Oh, God. So, well, we see Gran Torino talking on the phone with All Might, and he's like, oh, you know, freaking Izuku, thanks to him, my teaching license got revoked for 6 months, and I got pay a cut, too. Oh, well, I didn't really have much choice. He acts before he thinks, just like you, Toshinori. And All Might's like, I'm sorry, I guess I didn't really teach him well enough before hanging him over to you. He's like, no, I really mostly just got my teaching license so I could teach you in the first place. It was all a promise to your predecessor, Shimura. And we get a fucking info dump! Oh, this fucking wall of text here. Basically, they talk a little bit about All Might Shimura, All Might's predecessor, rather. They talk about the hero killer, and, you know, Gran Torino says, you know, I was really actually intimidated by the pressure of his fierce ideals. You know, I'm not praising the guy, but, you know, your whole symbol of peace thing, that sense of duty, it was like that, the same thing. You know, he's got this tremendous charisma, and, you know, his ideals and opinions, they're going to get up there because of the investigation going forward. They're going to get on the net. They're going to be in the papers, the magazines, on TV. This age we live in, for better or for worse, is one of suppression. But mark my words, people are going to be influenced by this. So All Might is like, oh, so heroes will deal with them just like this time, though. It'll be fine. It's like, no. And then there's this League of Villains. The media is already making the connection. So this league is going to go from the gang who attacked UA and got beaten at their own game to an organization with something to say. In other words, they're the perfect magnet. The evil of individual thugs isn't worth much. But when it's united by a single will, it'll become 100 times more dangerous. And there's ants in the background, because it's like when ants work together, Chris!
I mean, I'll be honest, Dick, the most terrifying horror story I ever read was Lion King versus the Ants, so you might have a point. They fucking eat a horse in that mech. It's terrifying.
Why would they eat a horse?
I think they just go to, it's an example they used to show. It's like the Brazilian fire ants, I think it is. And they just explain that, like, it can eat a full-grown horse in, like, 12 seconds or something like that. Something ridiculous. Yeah. They're terrifying, Nick. If the ants are as real as they were in that story, where they hurled themselves into the river so that the rest of their army could float across it on their fucking corpses, then I just, like, nuke that entire area they might be in, because I can't trust that.
Just, like, raise all of Brazil to the ground.
Yeah. I mean, that seems like it's a little,
They're like, millions of people will die, but if I never have to meet Brazilian fire ants,
it's worth it. There's like a 90% chance you're never going to meet those ants anyway. 99% chance. You know what
I mean? I don't care. I was almost killed by regular fire ants when I was a kid.
We're just like,
I was allergic to fire ants. Maybe I'm allergic to Brazilian fire ants, and they're extra, extra deadly, Chris.
I mean, they're super deadly as it is. I think if they want to eat you and all that's, like, standing between them is, like, a can of Raid, I think you're screwed no matter what. But let's just hope that we don't get involved in any, like,
I don't
want
to have an allergic reaction before they eat me to death, though.
You're like, oh, my throat's closing up. I'm going to be eaten to death. This is so lame. I won't be able to get out any cool death words. I'm dead and never coming back.
I like it. I mean, I have to reach my EpiPen, but my arms have been chewed off. No!
No! You fiends! Don't you know any honor ants?
So, Gran Torino is like, okay, you know, they're removing their obstacles and manipulating the whole situation according to their calculations. You know, I've got to And All Might says, you know, I've had a bad feeling about this. And Gran Torino agrees, yeah, Shimura was my friend and your predecessor, the last user of One for All. And the man who killed him, the man who opened up that hole in your gut, I think we can assume that All for One is back again. Dun dun dun.
Bum 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 bum.
Gran Torino tells him, you know, that little kid's admiration for you is no joke, so you better find a chance to sit down and tell him everything. Tell him everything about you and One for All. And then we get two gangsters sitting down and talking about the hero killer, and basically we get a little info that says, oh, his real name is Chizome Akaguro. Deeply impressed by All Might's debut, he sought to become a hero. Akaguro attended a private high school for hopeful heroes, but soon despaired over the fundamentally corrupt view of heroes within the educational system. He dropped out the summer after his freshman year. Through his late teen years, he made soapbox speeches about the need for a hero revival, but this ended when he concluded that words alone are lacking in power. In the 10 years that followed, Akaguro educated and trained himself in the art of killing, all to fulfill his so-called duty. He's for a hero revival. According to Akaguro, hero should not be a title given to those seeking reward and recompense, but one earned through tireless self-sacrifice. The heroes of this era are pretenders and misrepresent themselves. Only through a relentless purge can society be made aware of this truth. So yeah, video got leaked of the fight. People are being drawn to him. We get a montage of several villains, including a couple that we've seen before. And one gangster guy is like, you know, from the punks with few priors to the really bad guys in the run. Anyone who's anyone, myself included, of course. All that evil scattered around out there. We're all gripped by the same fever. We'll be drawn to the organization he was working with. The League of Villains.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, I got a little bit out of this chapter. I like how the fight with Stain is a huge launching point into something much bigger now, as opposed to just like a fight that just kind of happened now. And he's really being pushed forward as this very important figure still. So, yeah, stuff.
It was cool that the only thing I think I didn't care for was the reveal about Stain, if only because it seemed like kind of a... Well, the way it was delivered is, you know, it's purely just stated. It was like, here's his backstory. And it comes in with the follow-up of, here's how it applies to what is now going to happen. But it did just feel like, kind of felt like we could have had a bigger story than, it just didn't really feel like school was that big of a deal, and he kind of became jaded and just...
Yeah, and I was under the impression like he had actually been a hero who became disgraced or something. It was just like, nah, he got disillusioned and decided to do things his own way. I was like, well, okay.
Whatever. It's fine, it's just a little bit...
I'm with you. I built it up in my head already. So
hopefully there's still more from him than that. Although it's kind of hard to see him in the same light as like, oh man, I can't wait to find out what this dude's story is. Knowing it's like, oh, he's just like me in high school, but he actually became a supervillain. Right. Instead of just talking about being one.
Oh god. Let's move on to One Piece chapter 799. Father and Sons. I know some people were talking about Nisekoi earlier. I'm glad to see there might be an actual fight scene. I don't have my hopes very high up, though. I don't think Matsu's going to come from it, because we'll see.
He did double arts, Nick. There was a fight scene in that. It was pretty cool.
So, One Piece. Luffy has vowed he's going to actually fight Fujitora, because we can't run away from the admirals anymore. And as he does it, he's calling his attacks ahead of time. He's like, I'm going to kick you. Got to punch you now. Here comes a kick and a punch. Head, butt. I'm going to stop you. And everyone's like, what's going on now? Why are you doing this, Luffy? And Zoro was like, you know, I agree with what Luffy was saying earlier, but why is he fighting like that? Makes no goddamn sense. And so Fujitora says, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, I can tell you've got the strength to back your words, and I appreciate your spirit. But what the hell are you doing calling your moves out ahead of time? Are you taking sympathy on me? You know, it's like, come on, I'm an admiral of the Navy. I'm a freaking monster. Are you marking me? Is that what you're doing? You know, does it bother you that you're fighting a blind opponent? You know, if you wanted to get my goat, mission accomplished, your head will fly from your shoulders in a minute. But Luffy replies, I just can't whoop you without saying anything when I already know you can't see. I don't think you're that bad of a guy. And Fujitora goes right from one extreme to the other as he makes this, as he just sputters out laughing. And Luffy's like, oh, what are you laughing? I'm going to kick you again. Goes right back to calling his attacks. So Fujitora says, like, you're being illogical. You're not going to gain anything from this. When a fight man fights, he has a standing to uphold, and that leaves no room for honest sympathy and likes and dislikes. And, yeah. So, something, like, crumbles behind them? I'm not
basically
really sure.
What happens is Fujitora does his gravity blade attack. He hits it, Luffy blocks it, but the pressure it exerts is so much, you can see the effect it had on the environment behind them, where it destroys, like, this. It basically just blows, like, starts destroying the wall that was behind Luffy, what looks like a mile away or something like that. Mm-hmm. It just goes to show how powerful his gravity blade attack was.
Right. So, yeah. The fight is suddenly interrupted when Hajruddin, the giant, grabs Luffy and is like, we're leaving now.
Nick, you won't have to remember this guy's name. He's not going to be a factor in this.
No, he's definitely never going to show up again. And Zoro's like, all right.
I'll fight him now.
Partima's like, no!
He's got a sword. I get to fight him.
We got our own needs to see, too. Needs? Yeah, I'll bet if he didn't have a sword, he wouldn't have been as big up on it. Yeah, good point. So Usopp's like, wait a minute. Isn't there only one ship here? And one of the guys, whose name comes up later, but I don't remember now, he's like, no! Who would dare to dock their ship in such an unstable location? They're like, oh my god, it's a whole line of ships lined up in, like, single file. And they're like, yes, our ships extend out into the mist 3 miles away. Look at all of them! And Luffy's still like, oh, I just don't want to fight him. And Fujitora says, it's far too late now, Straw Hat says. Hajruddin runs down the line of ships with everybody to get to their actual ship that they're trying to reach. And he says, I may not be able to see, but I know it's there before your eyes. A black sky with no escape. An endless downfall of rubble that sinks every ship fleeing to sea. Don't you see it? Even if you escape from me, your life will be in peril by the four emperors now. Now that you've eliminated Joker, your future is hell. You showed pity for my blind eyes, but I earned my lack of sight by my actions. I shut these lids on my own, saw too many things I didn't care for. Now, I can at least guide you to hell myself.
It's an awesome fucking little monologue from him that gives us a lot about his character, too.
Yeah.
His whole note about what he's seen and now that may be ultimately why he's lost his sight. And that follows up with basically his little bit from here on in.
Yeah. It's this really pretty goofy moment where all these people from the kingdom come rushing in. They're like, get Rebecca back, Lucy! You're supposed to be a hero! Come on, man! And everyone's like, where are you guys? Fujitora's like, what are you guys doing? It's just a bunch of criminals and pirates over there. He's like, oh, come on, move it, Navy! We don't want your help! We're gonna drive those pirates off themselves! And everyone, despite saying this, is just like, ha-ha, you better watch out, Luffy! You got these big old grins on their faces. Oh, we're gonna chase them out to the open sea! And Fujitora says, they don't sound angry in the slightest. What the hell's going on? And everyone's like, what are they doing? What are they doing? Wait, Lucy! And we get kind of a flashback to everyone, I guess, having the conversation before they ran here, which is, oh, Rebecca's in the house on the hill. She's with Kairos. It's like, we already know about that already. Of course this would happen after the way Kairos withdrew. They're a father and daughter, after all. What? All the adults knew about that. Yeah. You know, Kairos and Rebecca and Scarlet, they were all living together happily in this little house on the hill. And also, we know about the fairies. We just, you know, don't talk about it because we keep the secret together because we're good people.
Like, also, we also know about Freddy Krueger, but don't tell your kids about him, because that could cause problems.
That'd be a dick move. And Sarah's like, get back Rebecca there, see? We think you got Rebecca, totally. But yeah, they're basically like, you know, if we run out chasing the pirates, then he won't be able to drop the rebel. We'll be able to protect them as this, you know, last little bit method of repaying them, which is like, good stuff. And Fujitora is no fool. He's like, oh, Luffy, honest to a fault. Everybody seems determined to save you. What kind of man are you? What color is your hair? What shape are your eyes? What features do you wear? I suppose I shouldn't have closed these eyes, now that I want to take a gander at your face. I reckon it must look mighty kind.
Awesome. It's such an awesome little character bit we get with him, too. And I just noticed this, you know, a week in Jump where there was so much great art. This is another series that had a great visualization of a scene where it's, you know, it's nothing out of the ordinary considering it's a trope that's been done before. But we see when Fujitora is addressing or he's seeing the people who are coming from the crowds, we see it from a world of pitch blackness with him, but he can make out the images as just, you know, undefined kind of humanoid-esque figures. So we're kind of getting those scenes from his perspective where he just sees these moving human figures in pure darkness screaming. And you're just like, ah, it's kind of like a cool way to interpret the way he views the world. I guess maybe that's how he can see with hockey or something like that. He can't see the specifics. He just sees featureless blobs, and maybe that plays a little bit into his own philosophy of justice. So it's a really cool aspect there, and I love how it ends there with him kind of thinking back, like, oh, I want to see your face now to see, you know, the kind of person you are.
Sounds cool. I really like Fujitora. I mean, I liked him before, but I really like him after this chapter.
He's cool. Made him very compelling.
So I honestly think this would have actually been a fine part to just stop the chapter, but we get a tremendous development after this point that we gotta talk about instead. As Bartolomeo is like, oh, everyone, here's our ship. Feast your eyes on this baby, the Yanta Maria. Ain't she a beauty? And everyone's like, that's not your ship. He's so proud of it.
But I love what he says, where he's like, I'll show you my ship later. You guys will freak. I swear to God, if he has the going marionette, I may cry.
Oh.
Like, he's like, I built a scale replica of it.
Oh. Which,
like, he's like, and the spirit's back, like, Luffy! He saved me from the ocean!
But yeah, the Yanta Maria is this fucking massive ship. Like, because we see Hydrogen, you know, standing out amongst the crowd looking up at it, and it freaking dwarfs him. It looks like it could hold an entire crew of giants, basically, which, as it turns out, that is basically why it exists. Yeah, mm-hmm. Hydrogen explains, you know, I'm going to try and rebuild the giant pirate crew that once shook the foundations of the world. I've got, you know, four fellow mercenary giants with me, and one day we're gonna reunite that crew. It's like, oh, that's cool. I like that. You know, I like to see that whole, you know, everyone's got a dream thing, and it's a nice little moment. Like, we got the ship already! Ah! It's going to be a bitch to actually man it until we find the rest of the crew, but we'll be good! And Luffy's like, oh, I look forward to seeing that, because you guys will be, you know, rivals and stuff. And even Usopp's excited. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, it'll be a return to the glory days of Dorian Brogy. It's like, oh, and that's a nice shout out there.
And quick remembrance that Usopp has the dream to go visit Elbaf, the land of the giants.
Yeah. So, yeah, and Orlumbus, that's his name. He's there. He's like, yes, my Yanta Maria fleet is comprised of 56 ships in all. They will surely be an aid to you. And then, and Robin's like, we mean aid. And Leo's there, and she's like, we have the Chief Tonta's permission. You gotta let us join up. And they're like, what are you talking about? And much of the Coliseum commands are there. There's Ideo and Blue Gilly and Abdullah and Jeet, and they're all there. And they're like, yeah, we're gonna help join us up too. And Suleiman, I don't even remember him being
Suleiman the butcher. Of course, yeah, he was the war criminal.
Okay, yeah, he's like, and I've been allowed to ride on this guy's ship, and Cavendish is there. He's like, when I am here, I'm your captain.
It is sort of weird. I thought Cavendish was a bounty hunter. I guess he's just become a pirate at the end of this.
I guess so. So Luffy's like, what are you guys doing? I mean, do whatever the hell you want. They're like, well, the thing is, in the 2 days we were hanging out at the palace, we all kind of, you know, got along. And Orlumbus says, we arrived at this order by drawing lots. First, the 75 members of the beautiful pirates led by their captain, White Knight Cavendish. Next, leading the 56 in the Barto Club, Captain Maneater Bartolomeo. Is he actually a cannibal? That might go down to 55 really quickly. Donsai, the 13th chieftain of the 1,000-strong Haposui army. Ideo, Can of Destruction, representative of the four-member XXX gym-fighting alliance. That sounds dirty. What kind of gym-fighting do they actually do?
Well, let's turn back a page and look at the four men who were in that group. You got a big fat guy. You got a really kind of gross-looking dude with a giant sword. You have Blue Gilly, who has super long legs, and Adeo, who has super long arms. So you're in for a lot of fetish porn.
He's called Long Arm XXX Boxer Adeo. What the fuck is that XXX?
He's like, it's for Super Extreme!
Fifth, Leo the Warrior, commander of the 200 members of the Tanta Corps. Sixth, Captain Hydrogen of the future giant pirate crew, still at just 5 members. And I am the Commodore of the 4,300-man Yonta Maria fleet, the adventuring pioneer, Orlumbus. That's 5,600 in total, Mr. Luffy. Now join with us, the 7 leaders, and ritually exchange the cups of father and son. And Luffy's like, father and son? And Bartolomeo says, yep, you're the father figure, the boss. We're the sons, your followers. Let us take our rightful places under the affiliation of the Straw Hat Pirates.
Dun, 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 dun.
Now, Chris.
Yes.
I know he's not joining the main Straw Hat crew, but are you happy Bartolomeo's technically going to be a Straw Hat?
He's not technically going to be a Straw Hat, Nick.
He's affiliated with Straw Hat.
He's affiliated. Yes and no. I mean, it's a bummer. I want him to be involved in every adventure the Straw Hat's ever had for the rest of time, and I may just write fanfiction that includes him in things. But you'll notice there's one person missing from all this, Nick.
Where's Belly?
Well, I was going to say Moosey, but where's Belly? I was expecting Moosey to actually show up. I was like, oh, he'll show up on one of the crews. But it is interesting. I wonder where Bellamy is in this, because I would have assumed he would have joined up with somebody. I'd like to... Oh, man, it'd be kind of funny if, like, he joins, and everyone's like, no, you can't join, and we have 5,601 people. It's not an even number.
Aww.
It's like that whole thing that we can't make Puerto Rico a state. There'd be 51 states. They're
decorate the flag. It'll be weird. We just finally figured out how to put fucking 50 fucking stars on this thing.
Yeah, 51 states? That's confusing for children. 50 states? Everyone can learn that. No, it is actually really cool. I mean, I wasn't expecting some of these people to be important people, but in retrospect, it makes sense because almost everyone involved in this had some sort of significant role during that arc. It makes a lot more sense now that Hadrodin had that fight with, what was his name? The ton guy. Mav.
The guy who could, like,
decrease his weight.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember his name. Mav something.
Was it Mach Vice?
Mach Vice, I think. Maybe. Yeah. I think I might have been it. Yeah. But anyway, it made sense that Hadrodin had, like, they gave him, you know, a focus in that. And
yeah.
I believe Adeo had a focus on with Derringer. And, you know, obviously we got a big fight out of, you know, Sai and Bartolomeo.
Yeah,
and
I like how I like how the three most important members of this are people that we've gotten to know pretty damn well through this, you know, with that focus on Sai as well as on Don Jinjiao, and, you know, then, yeah, on Cavendish and Bartolomeo. So we're just like, okay, you know, these are guys who are now closely affiliated with the Straw Hats, and we've gotten to know them through the course of this arc. So it actually also kind of goes to explain a little bit about how the way the arc unfolds. Like, oh, well, these guys are going to be important characters now.
Yeah, and that means a lot to know that these characters weren't just introduced and almost felt like filler in a large arc where we kind of wanted to see the other Straw Hats get to do something. It's like, no, these are characters who are going to have some significance going forward, and it's kind of cool to just see all this unfold. I think more than anything, I'm more curious to see what this father and son ritual is, because I feel like we're about to get a cool piece of lore of One Piece's world out of this. Unfortunately, we won't get that for basically 2 weeks, because One Piece is off next week.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed this chapter a lot. Honestly, I could go on for like another 40 minutes on this chapter, but we're already kind of running long with this episode.
I'm starting to lose my voice. Let's hit
Toriko still has a fucking spider who can control time, and no one's going to explain it, and I don't want anyone to ever explain why this spider can fucking control time. The end. Alright, world trigger.
You didn't even talk about Midoriya facing up with
Zoro. I don't care. I just, that fucking spider annoys me and it just delights me at the same time.
Chris doesn't want to talk about Toriko. There was a chapter. Fucking, what's his name, is a part of the first beast, I guess, maybe?
Acacia. It looks like Acacia is this beast, and that the thing that's on him is basically being used to control him and subdue him for the time being.
And he's eating a lot of stuff. And also, fucking Jinpei, I think. Jiro. And Jiro.
and Setsuno.
They came across this weird creature that ate a giant monster by, like, inhaling it, even though it's way smaller. I don't know.
Basically, a piece of this acacia monster fell off, and they're like, no! That thing could destroy the world! And they run into it, and looks like they subdue it, basically. Jiro, like, kind of cuts it.
Okay.
Knocking Jiro.
Let's do World Trigger now.
Yeah. Something actually happens in World Trigger. Holy shit, something happens in World Trigger.
So, chapter 114 on page 106, which is not loading now. There it is. Ah, this is my fucking voice. Masataka Ninomiya Part 2. So, yeah.
I wish I could be, like, assuring to you, Nick. Like, don't worry, it's a lot of action. So I click the next page, it's like, oh.
So Ninomiya managed to get Yuzuru briefly at one point in the last chapter, and is pursuing him now through the building, but we don't actually see how that fight unfolds as we immediately go to the attackers slashing the shit out of each other. And specifically, they're like, let's see, Kuga from Tamakoma and the two Azuma Squad attackers, they might benefit from having grasshoppers to reduce the effect of the snow, but Yuma's the first person to take a hit because Azuma is supporting. And he just shoots Yuma's foot clean off. And they're continuing to analyze stuff. And Kazama says, you know, they should actually get out of the space Azuma Squad controls. But on the other hand, Azuma Squad have this edge in maneuverability. And it's better for them if the enemy splits up. And then they can easily pick them off. So if they do try and break out, then Azuma Squad is going to get the points. So they're kind of caught. All the other people involved are caught in this bind, where they can't break off engagement, even though they don't have the edge. And in particular, Kuga is in really deep shit, because he's got no teammates, who we then see looking on, scared and worried, and Chika's kind of going through the same thing Osama went through last time, where she, you know, remembers, like, Yuma's saying, oh, if they think you can't shoot, but then you do, wouldn't that be interesting? And she just thinks to herself, if only I'd been able to shoot them.
I can't shoot her. She actually did something cool last week, Nick.
Well, yeah, but she specifically says, you know, if I had actually done it properly, then I would have gotten points. Yuma wouldn't have had to face so many of them alone. Osama's efforts wouldn't have been in vain. And so between her and Osama, it really is pushing this point of these guys can't continue relying on Yuma. They're going to come up short if they keep on doing this.
The funny thing is that both of those characters consider the entire thing to have been their fault, you know. Chika doesn't blame Osamu at all, and Osamu's not going to blame her if they're just placing all the blame on themselves.
So, yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, it looks like they're going to take a bit of it. Even if somehow, miraculously, Yuma gets, like, all the points and wins, which, by the end of this chapter, really looks unlikely.
It's almost statistically impossible at this point.
Then it seems as though they're going to take this loss on the chin and have to, you know, move on and get better. And even if they do miraculously win, it's clear, lesson learned, they better fucking get better from this point. So Zoe gets in contact with his Yuzuru and he's like, hey, do you want my help? And he says, nah, don't bother, go help Kage. Normally, in this situation, he wouldn't lose, but snow sucks. It's a great way of putting it. And then the wall bursts to his side to indicate that he's been found by
Ninomiya.
And Yuzuru is like, you should hurry. I won't be able to buy much time. I love how fucking calm he is the entire time, honestly. He is just like, I'm not going to make it. Go help him. Snow sucks. Well, don't have much time
left. Story of his book. It's like his book comes out. Snow sucks. The Emma story.
We get a bit of a fight between Yuma and the two Azuma Squad fighters. He does this really awesome thing where he has a scorpion blade emerge from his head to block a shot.
It is pretty good.
That is so awesome. But his arm gets cut off by Kohorai. He's just being ganged up on so much that he is really starting to lose. And actually, fucking, what's his name? The kid in Tamakoma Squad with the fucking Capybara. I keep on forgetting his name because he seems like he's...
Isn't that like Yuzu or something?
No, it's not like that. He's like, why are they going after Yuma? It's not fair! And Yuzu says, it's because he has a grasshopper. So once Yuma's down, then nobody's going to be able to catch up to Azuma with his snow camouflage. So it makes sense for them to target him. Yeah. Then they see that someone has bailed out because Emma has been forced out of the competition, and which means that the tide might start to turn, Kagura gets just shouts out to Zoe, and he's like, I'll pull Yuzuru's way too! Boom, 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 boom! And they just get shot out of the air. Asuma just fucking snipes all of his grenades.
He's like, dick!
He's like, oh, he sniped them! Aww. And then Asuma tries to fire a shot at Kitazoi to take him out now that he knows his position. But Ninomiya gets in the way, shields him from the blast.
He doesn't even take his motherfucking hand out of his pocket while he does this. He blocks the shot, turns, and he's like, that's my point. And just murders Zoe. And I don't care if he's a super douche Annalisa, he is awesome. And he's slowly slowly climbing up on Osamu, who's my favorite character in this series, if only for how much of a magnificent asshole this guy is.
Yeah, he's just like, this is my point. Kitazoi says, you're so right. And just fires a few more shots off.
Yeah, he's just like, boom, boom, boom. Good on ya.
And then he gets taken out immediately. But the grenades have been launched nonetheless. They start to destroy the houses beneath the Asuma squad's feet. That starts to turn the tide. Kagura takes out one immediately. The attacker from Ninomiya's squad tries to take another one out. But he manages to block it. Yuma dashes between them, cuts his arm off, cuts the other guy's head off. And then it looks like Asuma fucking takes out that attacker as well. And he's like, ah, the bomb's created a clear line of sight. My mistake. And he's forced to bail out. So it looks like we're down to Ninomiya, Yuma, Kagura, and Asuma.
It's all the aces, yep. Those are the only ones who are left.
I think that's who we're down to, because Chika's gone. Yeah. Osama's gone.
It's just the aces.
Asuma's two attackers are gone. Ninomiya's attacker's gone. Kitazoi's gone. Emma's gone. Was there a...
No, you got it. It's just the aces.
Was the third guy from Ninomiya's squad taken out? I forget.
Yeah, he was the one who got taken out by Kagura when he was chasing after Chika.
Oh, right. Okay. So yeah, it is down to just the aces. And
if you do the point tally, it looks like it's two a team, except for Tamakoma, which is only at one. Because it's sort of chaos here, but within it we can see that Kagura takes out one member of Asuma's squad. Then Yuma gets the killing blow on the other guy. Then it looks like Azuma gets the other killing blow on Nanamiya squad's attacker. So right. Those are going to be presumably the ones who got the points. But they notice this big chaos. Who got the points? But from what
Also, Tamakoma hasn't lost a point for Chika.
They haven't, but at the same time, they didn't gain a point for it either.
Right.
So it's just a point that didn't get lost, but they're still down, what it looks like.
So, Everyone's, the Yanagis are all like, oh my god, three fall wants to meet one after the other. Who's got the points? And Kagura squares off with Yuma, who's now missing an arm and a leg. And he's like, come on, shrimp. It's time to play.
It's just like, holy shit. Like, this chapter had so much action going in, and the last, like, four pages are just pure chaos. It's so exciting to watch. Like, I love Ninomiya blocks that shot. And, like, you know, I was like, nah, this is my point. And, like, you know, fucking Kita's always like, yep, in the last moment, so I'm going to fire up more grenades. And those grenades just start this chain reaction of absolute anarchy with people just getting sliced and cut apart and just absolutely torn apart. It's so engaging, so exciting to watch. I love just the first page of this chapter, the first panel, where we get this shot of just absolute anarchy that you can see between these five attackers going at it in this like alleyway. You just see things getting cut across, people jumping around, these blades coming out of all directions. Very exciting, and I love the way we've kind of now reached, I guess, the climax of this fight, yeah, where the only people are left are the big figures.
It can't last too much longer than this. So
it's very interesting. You know, who's gonna come out ahead? I can't believe Tamakoma comes out ahead. I feel like the fact that they're already down one point, Yuma's missing an arm, missing a leg. I feel like that's pretty much their way of, like, justifying, hey, he's not going to be able to beat these guys, two of whom are basically listed as being A-rank caliber opponents, you know, and he's severely handicapped. I feel like Yuma's going to lose this one. That fits in with the whole idea of, like, Jin has something coming up, you know, in store for Hayase and all that. But I am curious who ultimately wins in all this. I'm hoping it's Nanamiya because I really like him. But it really is an interesting scenario because they're all in different advantageous positions.
I mean, yeah, those three captains and aces are all completely uninjured. So it's basically an even it isn't even a match between the three of them, so mm-hmm. who knows who's going to win between those three. And it's probably not going to be Yuma, but maybe he'll, you know, be able to salvage them out of last place. Who knows?
Maybe he'll get a point. Maybe he'll do something to, like, steal a point the last second or something like that. Who knows? Maybe he'll get a kill and then bail out himself and then keep somebody else from, like, getting above them, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. But, look, I mean, you know, it's just been established that if you're missing, like, two limbs, you're going to just end up leaking too much try-on anyway and have to be forced to bail out even if you don't get any further injuries.
So. Yeah. So, it's a very interesting, very cool battle, very cool chapter. I gave us my chapter of the week just for how exciting it was, but
I would have to give it to Food Wars because it was just an awesome character introduction. Really impressed me.
Yeah.
But both really good chapters. Anyway, that's going to do it. Let's wrap up before I lose my voice completely. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap, which we record live on twitch.tv/RelloT. Normally, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change things up like we did tonight. So to stay updated, follow us on Twitter. He is at RelloT. I'm at Roller Time. There's a loud dog in the hallway that I want to punch.
Nick, you can't punch dogs. It's illegal. Michael Vick will tell you all about it.
He wasn't punching them. He was just forcing them to kill each other.
Yeah. I'm sure he never punched a dog at any point.
That's way less terrible. Be sure to check out past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. You can also check them out on iTunes. Just search for Weekly Manga Recap and be sure to leave a comment and rating for us.
Yes.
Do you have any new stuff on there?
I am currently trying to pull it up here. It was giving me errors before.
Well, in the meantime, while he's checking for that, also want to let you know that you can send us criticism, questions for us to answer on a future episode of the show, and suggestions for future manga for us to read.
We got one, Nick!
Awesome. By sending us an email, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com.
We got one here from AG Superman. He says, love listening to this podcast because it talks about One Piece, and hearing Nick's fantastic Saggy impression is great. I listen to you guys when you draw.
I've only done that once.
I'm not a big fan of wrestling. The only wrestlers I know are Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant because we share the same name. Besides, I love listening to this podcast because you talk about the other two great manga in the world, One Piece and Fairy Tail.
That's great.
Oh, he notes that the only negative thing is the wrestling talk.
Never do that ever again, yeah. Or else he'll stop us.
But no. Sincerely appreciate it, sir.
Yeah, thank you for your feedback. It helps us to beat the woodworking podcasts. Also, when Hana said never coming back, I think that I missed it last week, and I have to make up for it this time. Special thanks go out as well to our Patreon subscribers. We want to thank you so much for your continued support. It allows us to continue doing the show and continue making improvements and doing special stuff.
I just saw Geofugel posted up the Infamous Planet usually does a visual audition poll at the end of this episode. He's not able to catch the episode live this week, so J.L. Fugel put one out. And I don't know if it's official or not, but I just love that the options here are, like, wacky ones. And then there's one that just says, oh, bugger, he already got bloody fairy tale, call Blimey. Which is in fourth place at the moment.
Please hold your hand and butt, Food Wars and Taxes featuring Gab. Nisa Koi?
I guarantee if you had to do one chapter this week, it'd have to be the Food Wars chapter. I don't think I've laughed that hard in Weekly Manga Recap in so long.
Oh, that's great. Oh, I love that. I can't talk anymore.
You do just want me to list off patrons and I'll go into our
yes, please. Oh, okay. I'm out of water. How am I out of water? I put like a freaking pint in this thing.
Guys, thank you everybody who has been supporting our Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/weeklymangarecap, where you're currently coming up on our next goal, which would be basically anime related movie commentaries that we do a live stream of and give it to you guys. So we're getting close on that. And of course, we want to thank our patrons, those who have recently supported us. So a big thank you goes to Satellite of Love, to Fleffler, Truman Mossett, Jimmy Mullins, and Rolf Inge Heitman. I was really close to not screwing any of them up, but Inge confused me greatly. However, what is not confusing is my thanks towards you, Inge.
Oh.
So thank you to all of you guys. Greatly appreciate it. We are going to use that to help continue improving the show. And... yeah. Guys, I have a recommendation for our next series.
Before you get to that,
Okay.
I have to do thanks for Steve, man.
Alright.
YourRoxAmboyToDemon.com, IDarBoostToDemon.com, Patreon.com/Steveman. Also, Infamous Plant, whom we make fun of on a regular basis, but the visual additions he does for the show are awesome, as are those made by Felix Stark. Thanks to both of you guys. Go ahead!
Okay. So, I have a recommendation for this week. I considered at one point going with something, you know, a little bit, you know, maybe like a more well-regarded series or something like that. But I was like, you know what? I didn't have a lot of like a lot of an influence or a lasting impression of our last series. I'm gonna go with something that's a little bit shorter, but is certain to leave me with a long, stronger impression, if only because it looks like it could be just terrible.
Awesome.
It is a recommendation from Miko. Kirtsu, because I'm not going to try to pronounce that last name. I'm sure I screwed it up when you actually got the patron shout-out. But it's a series called Kurohime, which I'm just going to read you the description of. Kurohime is a buxom witch with the power to control magic guns.
What?
She once made a mistake of challenging the gods and was cursed for her foolishness. Transformed into a little girl named Himiko, she can only regain her former body and powers when she falls in love.
What?
But finding love in a world fraught with evil is no easy task. It sounds ridiculous, and I feel like it's something that we need. So, that is going to be our recommendation for next time. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Yeah, Kurohime. Awesome.
All right, Nick. I will forego an incredibly wacky joke this week, if only to give you the chance to go out and get some water.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
But the water is also cursed.
No!